It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Lauren Hawkinson joins us from the Next Web, along with Mark Million from Bloomberg Business Week, and all the way from France, Patrick Beja, to talk about quarterly results, Amazon, Microsoft, Google. It's the cloud, baby. We'll also talk about the new Boomerang app and demonstrate it from Instagram. And Jack Dorsey giving back a third of his Twitter stock to employees. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 533, recorded Sunday, October 25th, 2015. Two Hamiltons and a cone. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to Harry's.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TWIT5 when you check out. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way to create a beautiful website or online store. Enter the offer code TWIT and you'll get 10% off when you purchase. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. And by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit Lynda.com/twit2. That's Lynda, LYNDA.com/twit and the number 2. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And it's always fun because I get some of the best, most interesting journalists together, and we just basically, it's a gab fest. We actually were trying to figure out what the collective noun for hosts would be. How about a gab fest of hosts? Mark Million is here from Bloomberg Business Week. Good to have you, Mark.
I'm on board with gab fest.
You have a new title. You're now the business tech editor. Is that new?
No, not exactly.
You were global. You were the global.
Yeah, had more of a focus on global.
Now it doesn't matter.
It's just
anywhere in the world. That's where Mark Million is.
It's still global, I guess, if I'm focused on everything. But yeah, just general technology.
And you have a bulldog, if I'm not mistaken.
I have a French bulldog,
yes. It's a French bulldog, which is almost as good as a pug. That's what Lauren Hawkinson, I almost called you Hawkinberry. I did call you Hawkinberry.
You did.
Laura Hawkinson is like a Hawkinberry. The son of a Hawkinberry would be Lauren Hawkinson.
I guess. Is that Swedish?
I don't know. Is Hawkinson Swedish?
It is.
First time on TWiT. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are, I love your bow.
Thank you.
Very few TWiT hosts actually wear bows in their hair.
Yeah.
You might be the first.
You know, it's something that I just sort of picked up over time.
I
have about 20.
Is it your trademark?
It is. I don't think I've ever done a TWiT show without them.
Nice.
Every time I've been on Tech News Today and Tech News Tonight, it's
you
always
the
bow.
Love it.
Actually, I got inquired by one of the producers as to how many bows I actually own.
Well, now we know.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You have a knot of bows. Yeah. I wear bow ties frequently. Had I known, I would have worn my bow tie today. I apologize. Look who else is here. Not from Sweden or from Bloomberg. Patrick Beja from France.
Hey, so I usually wear scarves, and it's sort of become my French trademark.
Is it? Really?
I'm not wearing mine
now.
Now
you're joking.
But with the magnificent... No, I am. Wait. I'm going to go get a scarf.
Go get a scarf.
Now I have to.
While I explain that Patrick Beja...
things.
Last time he was here, he worked at Blizzard, but now he is a full-time podcaster, strange though that may sound, with Le Rendezvous Tech, frenchspin.fr, or actually frenchspin.com. Look! Now I remember. You do wear scarves.
Insanely fast.
You must
have like an entire closet of scarves. Yeah.
I always have a scarf handy not too far from me because at some points during the day, I might get scarf panic and I have to have one. So there you go.
I've heard that exists in France.
Scarf panic.
It does.
Oh, my God.
But only in France.
And for today's show, I don't know if we have it available to you. We have the binocular version of this show for no apparent reason because there's nothing you can do with that. But I got my Ricoh Theta S camera, which I pre-ordered months ago, finally came. $350 3D camera. It does 3D stills. And then you can do 3D video, which I... but we haven't figured out how to do it live yet. You need some software somehow to stitch this. It's live, but it's not, you know, it doesn't look like anything. It looks like you're looking at us through a snow globe.
It looks like it should work in cardboard, right? But it doesn't.
Really? But it doesn't. No, you know why? Because each one is in a separate camera. One's the front, one's the back camera. Mm. You need to stitch
them. Yeah, if you looked at this in cardboard, you would have one eye seeing the front and right. one eye seeing the back. That would be kind of weird. No.
Only good for certain kinds of lizards, but not, in fact, for humans. apparently Ricoh is coming out with stitching software. But that's what Google, with the jump thing, with a 16-camera rig. But that's like $10,000, the GoPro version of that. Mm-hmm. This is $358. I'm very intrigued. Anyway, we'll keep you posted, and eventually we'll figure out how to make this a live stream. Well, this was the week we got quarterly results from Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and boy, this was the quarter of the cloud.
Indeed,
it
was.
Is that the takeaway from all this, Mark Millian?
That is the common thread that all three of those companies have invested a lot into those businesses. Amazon being the first that got out way ahead of this move to the cloud, but Google and Microsoft being the latest comer to that group, but they're all way ahead of the legacy companies like IBM and Oracle, who are just getting hammered by this transition in the industry. And you see in the results from those three companies, they just absolutely murdered. I mean, their stocks were up, you know, anywhere between 8% and 12% after the earnings came out. They added a combined something like $85 billion in market cap in a single day.
Wow. Microsoft had the highest stock price it's had since 2000, since the Department of Justice inquiries into Microsoft's monopoly. I mean, and it's been a stagnant stock for years. But I think this is this is at least Wall Street's judgment on Satya Nadella, that he's done the right thing. He's moved Microsoft into the cloud. The other big story, at least from Microsoft's point of view, was that Bing, for the first time ever, is profitable. Bing made $1 billion. That's a shocker. Bing's the Microsoft, I guess it's more than just search, right? It's just Microsoft Online Services, right?
I think they did single out Bing making $1 billion. But you have to, I mean, yes, they are profitable, but they're not profitable in the sense that we think of search engine being profitable like, well, basically like Google. Probably it's mostly things like Yahoo using them and embedded into other OSs like Windows 10 and iOS for Siri.
And in fact, Yahoo's moving away, so it might be the end of the line for...
It is profitable, but it's not. People didn't all of a sudden started to go to Bing.com and start searching for stuff.
Right. Microsoft revenue as a whole down 12%, but that is. But the earnings beat the estimates, and that's really what the Wall Street's looking for. You know what? The part of the problem for all three companies is they're global companies, and the dollar's strength against global currencies means that they didn't make as much money as they could. Currency was the currency exchange rates were a big problem for these companies.
Yeah, that's been an issue for the last year to 2 years as the dollar has gotten really strong and the euro has gotten very weak, and especially in the last quarter or two as China has disappeared.
Yeah.
Their growth has gone, you know, has just completely vanished. But a lot of these companies, all these global companies, have hedging programs to minimize the risk from
they buy
currency.
Euros and they do some trading and things.
Exactly. Yeah, they invest in other things in certain markets to kind of hedge against any fluctuations in currency. But there's no like silver bullet against currency fluctuation.
Hard to read the results at Microsoft because the new reporting structure is extremely confusing. There are three segments: productivity and business processes, intelligent cloud, and believe it or not, they have a segment called more personal computing. Productivity, which is Office, SharePoint, Skype, Exchange, Dynamics, intelligent cloud, Azure, Windows Server, SQL Server, System Center, Visual Studio, Enterprise Services, more personal computing, retail, OEM, and volume licensing for Windows, patent revenue, Windows Phone revenue, such as it is, hardware devices, Xbox and gaming revenue, advertising and search revenue. In other words, miscellaneous.
Yeah, Microsoft's earnings are a pain.
This is a mess. I can't even. I'm
and the Intelligent Cloud, you would assume means cloud, and yet Office 365 is not included in there, which is
cloud
one of their
of
fastest yeah. growing cloud products.
So just to break it up, revenue of $6.3 billion for productivity with an income of $3.1 billion. Those are both declines, which you might expect because cloud was up a lot. Intelligent Cloud revenue of $6 billion, operating income $2.4 billion. That's a 14% increase in profit. More personal computing was down 4% with a mere $1.6 billion.
Yeah, you'll notice a lot of things are down, which would sound pretty bad initially. But there's because of this big industry shift to cloud revenue.
It's up in the right place, right?
Right. It's up in the right place. What you know, the industry and analysts all seem to think is kind of the future of where the industry is going. All the companies, the three, who all reported earnings on the same day that show promise in this area, they're getting rewarded for it by investors. And, you know, cloud revenue ends up looking very different on in earnings than – say like selling a box of Windows for $300-$400.
Why is that?
Because with selling Windows or selling Office, you sell it all at once.
It's done.
It's a huge, yeah, you got your big revenue, but that customer may not buy from you again for three or 4 years.
Cloud is like every month you get a little check.
Investors love cloud right now because it's like Netflix. It's like a subscription model and you can kind of...
it's more predictable, isn't it?
It's more predictable source of revenue, which investors like.
Yeah. Amazon is... I always thought a retail company, but no, Amazon's a cloud company more than anything else. Net sales at Amazon, well, I don't know. I can't. I'm not going to read any more of these numbers.
Amazon is kind of this unseen behemoth in cloud. I mean, everybody who is anybody worth their salt in cloud knows about AWS and how important it is and how vital it is to so many companies. But, you know, most people just think of Amazon as like the place where they buy their diapers or, you know, whatnot. And it's remarkable how they've sort of silently been able to take over cloud. And not only that, but sort of held back and grouped their cloud profits and structure in a way to essentially lay low and lay quiet and capture the business sort of before everybody else got wise to it, because now AWS is ubiquitous.
And Jeff Bezos is one of the top 10 most richest men and people in the world, right?
He shot just after their earnings, he shot up to number three richest American in the...
It's funny money. It's stock money, but he made $2.9 billion in one day in the stock price increase.
Yeah, he owns a newspaper for fun.
It's mind-boggling.
I wish there were more Jeff Bezoses who would subsidize newspapers.
Bezos is worth $53 billion, third richest person in the U.S.
The Koch brothers must be unhappy
about
that.
We're number four or whatever. That's not as fun as saying we're number one. That's just phenomenal. Mm. But I think you're right, Lauren, when you point out that Amazon, despite the fact, you know, of appearances, they really are the cloud leader, aren't they? I mean, there's lots of other companies, Microsoft and Google, you'd think would be cloud leaders, but Amazon saw the potential of the cloud and launched web services long before Azure or Google services.
And now it's integral into not only, you know, a lot of ways that companies do business, but also, I mean, every app spins up an instance of AWS practically. And they're gaining a lot of reliable money from a lot of companies that are not going anywhere. And they've sort of established themselves as top dog. It's interesting to see other people veer into cloud, you know, seeing kind of how Google finally steps into the arena and how Microsoft grows. But I mean, at this point, it's hard to think about anybody actually becoming a formidable foe to AWS.
Isn't that amazing? That's not what you'd think. But Bezos, and in fact, I think, as I remember, I read the Amazon book. It was almost an afterthought. We've got all these computing power, which we don't use after 5 p.m., maybe there's something we could do with it. It wasn't a huge, big strategic move. The other thing I think maybe this is telling is you watched the Walton fortune slowly dwindle away. They lost about a quarter of their net worth. That's brick and mortar retail, while Amazon, and particularly Jeff Bezos, soared. Is that just a coincidence, or is it also I think it's got to reflect the change in how we shop.
Well, one, I believe that Amazon is now the largest retailer in the world. I believe that they've officially passed Walmart.
There you go.
One. Two, I'm finding it really hard to not make a goodnight John Boy joke.
The Walton family.
Yeah.
They're all going to sleep now.
They're all going to sleep now. But it's true. It's now, Amazon is now surpassing brick and mortar stores. There's no such thing as this online retail versus brick and mortar. I mean, yeah. Amazon is retail at this point. And Walmart is struggling, as are other brick and mortar stores. So it's interesting to see how the landscape will change and whether or not going brick and mortar is going to ultimately be a niche market as we get more savvy with our Amazon Prime Now button, deliver yesterday.
I got that dash button. You know, I got one for toilet paper. You know that button you press and they send you toilet paper?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I got a 12-year at home, and I got 18 cases of toilet paper because he kept pressing it.
You can get notifications, though.
Well, yeah, I had it set up, foolish me, to auto-order. It says, well, we won't order a new one until the old one comes, but they're so damn fast that by the time I noticed this was happening, every other day I was getting a case of Cottonelle. I finally realized, oh, my God, Michael's pressing the button.
Yeah.
So I've hidden the button.
I don't know if how they're reporting their earnings, but another thing that Amazon has going for them is how international they are. I've noticed in France as well. A couple of years ago, a lot of people were using Amazon, but a lot of people were a little bit defiant and thinking, you know, basic not anti-Americanism, but thinking, oh, they're the big American company and we have to preserve our own blah, 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 and, you know, whatever. And slowly, with their Amazon Prime and their incredible services, and in spite of all the bad press they've been having, I've seen more and more of my friends starting to use Amazon with Prime, which is magical. You know, you just press the button.
So you even have Prime in France.
Yeah, of course. And they're improving it all the time, too.
Until that sounds recently, very chauvinistic of me. Before. I apologize. Why? No, you have Prime in France?
Hey, we have that in the third world
a couple of years ago.
No,
but you know, until a few months ago, you had to order before 3 p.m. right. in order to get right. your order on the next day. Now it can be later in some places, and so my friends who are tech heads are using it. But in the last few months, I've noticed my mom is using it too. She just tried it because I basically made her, and now she lives in a slightly remote location. She can't live without it. It's just become better, you know, the way she shops. She's like, if I need something, I'm not going to take the car and go somewhere. It's going to come to me.
That actually was the knock on Amazon for a long time, was it was, you know, very successful in the U.S. and maybe the U.K., but not an international seller. That sounds like that's changing. And that's, of course, going to make a big difference in overall sales.
What I think is really going to be important is how Amazon tackles Asia. A lot of Asian countries, specifically China.
Well, China's got Baidu, right? Or not Baidu. What is the...
Alibaba.
And yeah. Korea has Gmarket, which are both incredibly popular and sort of like the patriotic choice. When you live in those countries, you use those. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not Amazon will actually try to move into Asia in any concerted effort and really make their presence known in places where they're really... Shocker, the minority retail system.
You feel definitely. Like there's a collision between Alibaba and Amazon about to happen.
For sure, in China. But Amazon is investing an insane amount of money into India, which has, you know, for as behind as India's internet economy is, e-commerce in particular is an area where they're one of the biggest players in the world. There's two homegrown companies called Flipkart and Snapdeal, who do just insane amounts of... I mean, it's the second most populous country in the world, and Amazon is seeing this pop up like right before their eyes, and so they pledged over $1 billion to invest into India, and China's another good example with Alibaba is an area where I don't know that they're going to be able to push in at this point. Alibaba is a gigantic, gigantic company.
And Alibaba would love to be here, I think. I mean, I don't think that their ambitions are no less than Amazon's. The problem Amazon has is they paved the way, right? They showed you how to do it. Mm-hmm. And so it's no longer a secret sauce.
Yeah, the battleground is going to be some of these developing markets, like India, which is already more developed than a lot of the other countries, say in like East, Southeast Asia and Africa, that right. some of these global companies are starting to look more closely at.
You just build the infrastructure. That's what they do. That's what they did in the U.S.
Well, infrastructure, literally, the infrastructure is an interesting piece of the puzzle because in India, for example, there are no like FedEx or right. UPS that service a lot of these areas. Russia also has a company called Ozone, I think, that they had to buy up a logistic network, buy all their own trucks to deliver in person. And
Think they'll do that? In fact, they'd probably prefer to do that.
Amazon?
Sure. A ton of money goes to UPS because of Amazon. They're really tough with UPS negotiating those deals. Wouldn't they rather just do it themselves?
Maybe. I mean, I do see some Amazon-branded trucks driving around San Francisco.
That's the Amazon Now stuff, isn't it?
Prime Now. Prime Now is finally available, which is interesting because you would think that that would come to San Francisco much sooner, but actually it's been working pretty well in New York City. I have not, although I've really thought about it. I was sick all week this last week and was like, ooh, should I use Prime Now to order myself soup? And then I was like, no, I should go outside and see sunlight.
No, don't go see people.
I did. That's I made the social choice. I made the wrong choice. What I have heard, I mean, Amazon Prime Now is actually really interesting when it comes to interactions with Amazon's real-time deals and sales. That's really where it can get interesting is if you are looking at something and all of a sudden it goes on sale, you can get the Prime Now and they'll send it to you right away, and it's easier to get things that might otherwise sell out. That's what happened on Amazon Prime Day when they had the discounted Echo, I believe, and also a couple of the other stuff. They had it as a separate stock in Prime Now that you can access and get.
Sneaky.
I know. It's crazy.
Wow. Patrick Norton was on the new Screensavers yesterday, and he's been using Amazon Now. And he says it's
on the show to like answer trivia.
No, wouldn't that be funny? he said, I needed a hard drive. And he got it the same, you know, gets it like at 8 o'clock. He said the biggest problem was that they didn't let him know they delivered it. You don't really expect it's going to come that day. And it was sitting on his porch for a couple of hours because they didn't let him know.
But that's exactly what Amazon's selling. I mean, Jeff Bezos has said that they're a logistics company first and foremost, and that's about logistics going to be their prime objective. So as long as they can continue to progressively make their delivery process as painless as possible and also develop a culture of having painless deliveries, I don't think that Amazon is ever going to have any trouble, especially in developing countries. If you can have a reputation for bringing things like that, you know, like super quickly, then people are going to be more interested in trying you because, you know, you have developed this international reputation for delivering your toilet paper yesterday.
One of our,
I think the most impressive thing about Amazon is that they keep improving on all of this because by now they're a pretty old company in web terms, and they could very easily rest on their laurels because they're already they're basically the fastest, and most other companies are copying or lagging behind, but they're still finding ways to do things faster that at first seem kind of, you know, useless. Why do you need your thing delivered at 8 on that day? You can wait until the next day. That's already super fast, but they're still improving on things. And there's probably something to be commended about. It's becoming an Amazon love fest here. There are bad things to say about Amazon as well, but for now we're focusing on the good things. But it's probably a testament to Bezos's leadership that they're not just stopping and raking in the money, and they're still thinking about how they can improve whatever their service is.
What do you come down on? Are you aware in France of the New York Times versus Amazon kerfuffle?
We're aware of many of those. I didn't read that article specifically.
So the New York Times published a scathing article about Amazon saying
2 months ago.
Yeah. People were crying at their desks, and it was the worst work environment ever. Jeff Bezos fired back. And then that last week, I think it was, Amazon, one of Amazon's top executives wrote a long piece in Medium of all places.
Jay Carney, former press secretary for President Obama.
That's right. He's kind of a high level marketing guy.
It was pretty funny. It was like, oh, there you are. There you are, Dirk Cunningham.
Now we know what happened to him. Yeah. He said, you know, that one of the people that Wall Street, was it? No, New York Times used as their source was had been in, fired for fraud. And, you know, they really cast a lot of doubt on it. And then, of course, the New York Times responds back, their executive editor. It was just, and by the way, but the whole fight occurred on Medium of all places.
Good for Ev Williams.
Yeah. Very good for Ev Williams.
My favorite observation from that experience was Amazon trying to demonstrate that it cares about employees by throwing several of them under the bus. I mean, the entire argument yeah. built around like these few employees that you ex-employees that you quoted in your story. Here's all of this inside information from our company that proves that there were bad people.
On the screen right now is actually an article I wrote. I called it a fact check slap fight.
I think that's a great. You are. Do you write your own headlines?
I do.
Because your headlines are awesome. Popcorn got burnt and all we got was butter. Your headlines are good.
I'm like, what is it? I'm not even like a small time stand up comedian. I'm like a micro time stand up comedian when it comes to like my headlines.
Headline comedy has a long and
fact check slap fight. It was real though. Thank you.
It was
really funny because you know, it was like months ago. It's one of those things that's become sort of a PR tactic where a company months after or weeks between weeks and months after a story, a hit piece has been filed, they'll generally go to Medium and do sort of like a glorified press release of sorts that like demonstrates the proper amount of outrage about how reporting was conducted. That's basically what Jay Carney did. He, you know, questioned a lot of the sources. He talked about the validity of some of the programs that that the New York Times had described. It was a lot of just semantics months after the fact. And, you know, it was just so far back in the news cycle. I had to think about it for a minute.
Right.
Because especially when it comes to tech news, it's like, you know, there's a new drama every day. So when you look at it from this perspective, it's like, what? I thought Bezos already said something, Carney. Wait.
And from a public relations standpoint, why do you drag this back up two months later?
Yeah.
I mean, there must have been some recruiting problems for Amazon behind the scenes that would have been the impetus for something like this. But still, you don't wait that long to give your rebuttal.
Yeah. And also I mentioned that pretending to be mad on Medium and releasing sort of like this press release style thing that's like, we're a good company of you know, noble breed and we are honorable and chivalrous to our employees. It's like, yeah, okay, just do it. I think that people would rather you show that you're not that company than if you just stomped around and threw a fit about it.
Part of it, though, is Google, that when you search for Amazon, you might find those articles. And so there is, you know, this is why the right to be forgotten for some people might not be a bad thing. Google surfaces this stuff. Yeah, it may be old news, but it got so many links and so much attention 2 months ago that it's still ranking high in a Google search. Mm-hmm. And that might be something that Carney feels like they have to do something about. In fact, that's one of the theories that came up in a New Yorker article. Headline, why did Jay Carney use Medium to criticize the New York Times?
With a great cranky Jay Carney photo.
But you're right. If anything, that, you know, that affects the Google search. When you search for that thing, you probably get the New York Times article and the response. So
you think that's why they might have done it in Medium as well? Does Medium have more Google juice?
It's possible. I mean, Medium has become, surprisingly, I think, a place where you go to post, I was going to say serious talks, but it might be more accurate to say seemingly serious talks. And for some reason, when you see something on Medium, it has that air of respectability, probably more than if it was on some other random blog. Medium has become a place where you go to air your deep thoughts about, you know, your theories about the tech world and about the message you have to pass to your people. I'm not sure why Medium works that way, but I think it kind of does for most tech reporters now.
All right, we're going to have some fun because I want to talk about Jay Peretti's post about BuzzFeed, which ties into this, and the new media world, which is changing very rapidly. This is fun. Great panel. Mark Millian's here from Bloomberg Business Week. Patrick Beja from Le Rendez-Vous Français.
Frenchspin.com. I almost said presque. Presque. Rendez-Vous Tech.
Le Rendez-Vous Tech. text in an English word. You got to, you really, that Academy is not going to like that.
Well, it's also technology. Oh my God, what am I saying? Technology, which is also a French word. So
how about,
there you go, Laporte.
What's the word for computer?
Laporte is a French word.
Laporte's a French word. What's the word for computer in France? Get this.
So in French, computer is ordinateur, which actually means a thing that computes. So it was back in the day when we actually translated words. And if we did that today with any other, you know, tech-related topic, we would be outraged that we can't even use the English word. But for some reason, back in those days, it was normal.
That's L'Académie Française,
right? The French, the L'Académie Française, did the French consortium finally make email okay? Or is that still like Le Communiqué Electronique?
So, well, basically, all right. I never miss a chance to make fun of my own language. Basically, we have a bunch of different ways to officially, according to the French Academy, to say an email. And one of them is a French way of writing the English word mail, which is mail. It's basically a transcription of the way you pronounce mail when you misread it as a French person.
Mail.
It's ridiculous. Yes, it's mail. So you could say, oh, I'm going to send you a mail. And that's the way you're supposed to say it. There are basically every word now is translated or, you know, adapted by the Académie Française. It's infuriating. But again, ordinateur makes sense.
I like it.
It would be completely ridiculous if someone said in French, oh, je veux acheter un computer. It would sound, I was going to say retarded, but that's
really
not good.
Sounds good to me.
No, it sounds weird.
Sounds right.
I think in Canada, they say it. And in that case, the French Canadians get angry because they shouldn't use English words.
I'm told in Quebec that the translation for email in Quebec is courriel,
which is that works too.
That's
that
a nice word. That works in French as well. I like that.
Yeah. And also people who are non-English speakers sort of complain all the time that speaking English kind of sounds like you're eating metal, which makes total sense.
It does make sense.
It clings around. It's not a great language.
But guess what?
Tech linguistics corner.
I feel like it's good. I don't want to be, again, I'm going to sound like a chauvinist, but which is, by the way, a great French word. isn't English becoming more and more dominant? Or is that changing thanks to the web? Are national languages reasserting themselves?
I think a lot of people are speaking English that maybe wouldn't have before just because they're exposed to a lot of that language. And the cultural dominance has always been there, I mean, for the past few decades. And the web basically transports that. But, you know, even beyond the fact that it's coming from English-speaking countries, people who need to communicate who might not have English as a native language are probably going to navigate to English because that's the easiest. Yeah.
It's actually an issue that they're having at Google for Google Translate. They found that so much of the majority of web pages on the internet are English that they're having a hard time being able to accurately translate smaller languages like Bulgarian into
they don't have
Google
a big
Translate.
Enough database?
They don't have a big enough database to catalog all of the words. So they've actually started polling countries and asking them to help in collecting and gathering words and phrases to make Google Translate more accurate because they can't rely on internet crawling alone to do the
people.
Work.
Shocking.
People.
And I don't know if it's related to the amount of information they have, but even for digital assistants like Siri and Cortana, it's just two examples, but it seems that they've been more accurate in English faster than they have been in French, for example. So I usually use them in English rather than French.
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we didn't get to Google's results. We'll do that. And yes, I want to talk about the BuzzFeed post and a whole lot more. We got a great panel, as I mentioned. Patrick Béja, that's where this all started, was me mispronouncing the name of your podcast network. Just go to frenchspin.fr. And you're just doing it in French, right? For a while you were doing...
I actually, Yeah, I actually have I relaunched the Phileas Club.
Oh, good.
So I also have FrenchSpin.com.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I have a couple of shows in English available at FrenchSpin.com.
That was a great show. I like the Phileas Club. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's... we actually... just get through your ad. I'll do my shameless self-promotion later.
We can do it anytime. So this self-promotion are us. We should probably talk about the Star Wars trailer as well.
Happy to.
Yeah. Our show today, though, brought... Oh, and also here... did I mention you, Mark? I did.
You did.
I know who I left out. Lauren.
Yeah.
Lauren Hawkinson is here from thenextweb.com. And our show today brought to you by Harry's. Time to shave. Harry's is for guys who want a great shaving experience for a fraction of what you're paying now. Look, nobody likes shaving. I'm going to admit it. You sometimes you scrape yourself with dull blades, and the blades are crazy expensive. That's why they lock them up at the drugstore. $4 a blade for the Fusion? But there is a company that is changing all that, Harry's. They decided to disintermediate shaving. I like this idea. They make their own blades in their own factory in Germany. Yes, they bought the factory. That's how we do it nowadays. You get that venture funding. You say, you know, how can we make this work better? Well, what if we owned the factory? Because then we can design blades for sharpness, for performance, and because we sell direct, we can sell them for a lot less, like half the cost of those expensive blades. Plus, they ship them free. Harry's.com. I want you to check out the Harry's kits, because that's how you start. The Truman kit, $15. The Winston kit, $25. That's a metal handle. And the actually, I really like the Truman set. And with both sets, you get three blades, plus the travel cover, plus the foaming shave gel or the shave cream, your pick. Very, very nice. And you know, we could take $5 off if you use the offer code TWIT5 at checkout. So that means the Truman's going to be like $10. What a great gift, a great way to get started. And then you sign up for the subscription. If you wish, you can get the blades shipped to you automatically. You can get the shave cream or the shave gel shipped to you. They also have aftershave balm and other great products, moisturizers. Harry's.com. They're making shaving a little bit better. Just use the offer code TWIT5 at checkout. I just found out, speaking of German engineering, that Hollywood has already optioned the Volkswagen scandal for a movie.
Leonardo DiCaprio is on board.
Who's he going to play?
Who do you auction it with?
I don't think I know the players in the VW scandal well enough.
Yeah, who do you go to? Well, there must be a book.
Go to Volkswagen and go like, hey, we want to do a movie on that scandal.
It's based on a optioning based on a book that has yet to be written by, I believe, a New York Times staff writer.
Yeah, Jack Ewing. He's writing. The story isn't even fully told. We don't even know what's going to happen, and yet there'll be a movie.
Got to get those movie rights early.
Wow.
Yeah.
The early betting is that Leonardo DiCaprio will play Martin Winterkorn, the chief executive.
The renowned Martin Winterkorn.
I don't know.
I can picture it now.
Leonardo is Martin Winterkorn. Nah, I don't think so.
This is Martin Winterkorn.
Okay, it's Leonardo gonna be a DiCaprio lot of makeup.
And this guy.
Have they hired Aaron Sorkin to write it? Because if they do, you know Volkswagen's going to win in the end.
Have you seen the movie?
Horrible.
Really?
Yeah. Did you like it?
I liked it.
It's a good Aaron Sorkin movie. It's a great Aaron Sorkin movie.
You need to go into it thinking. I'm going to see a movie. Same with Social Network. If you wanted a factual recount of the founding of Facebook, you don't go to see that movie.
No, that's true. They didn't talk about any of the good parts of Steve Jobs. That's my big problem with it. Of course he was that way, but he also was a leader who inspired people to do their best work. People stayed with him for years. He had a loving family. They don't even mention his wife and his three kids. When I spent the weekend with Steve, Lisa was with them. She was a high school kid, and they loved her. Everybody was happy. It just wasn't the Steve Jobs that any of us remember. That's the problem I have with it. But you're right. As long as people know that that's not real. So it's no Sorkinisms either.
None?
I couldn't find any.
Maybe not. I didn't go into it thinking.
I think Aaron saw that YouTube video and said, "Whatever I do, I'm not writing those."
I haven't seen it yet, but I can't believe that there is zero Sorkinisms considering how Sorkin feels about tech and about...
Oh, he hates tech.
Yeah.
Oh.
And people who are in tech or run tech companies,
yeah.
I can't believe that they didn't have some random person somewhere. I don't know. The person who was lint rolling Steve Jobs' turtleneck saying something along the lines of how, you know, being so close to technology is apt to change your moral character, right, or some blah, blah.
Actually, I felt like there wasn't a lot of soapboxing against technology in the movie. I don't recall him doing a lot of that. I mean, he does do a lot of that in interviews and in some of his movies.
Well, even Danny Boyle, the director, who we had a great interview with, I really liked Danny Boyle, said the problem with these tech titans is they've become virtual governments and nobody, they have no oversight. And so people like Jobs, Larry Page, wield immense power without, they're not elected officials, without any oversight. And that's not a bad point of view, a bad point to make, I should say. But that's also sounds like a political point of view. Like, we need to take these guys down a notch. They need to be more accountable.
Yeah. I mean, they should be accountable. I wouldn't say that they're dictators. I mean, they're we vote for them with our dollars by buying their products, and investors, you know, give them their money based on...
You know, one of the problems with that, though, is we don't really know what we're voting for. For instance, how do we give Google our dollars?
You go to Google instead of going to Bing, which just had the first profitable quarter.
But I don't think people are thinking in terms of that, right? They're not saying, oh, I'm putting in a vote for Larry Page and the way he runs Google. I'm just using a search engine.
Well, then
I think in some cases, people are aware of the potential issues. For example, data privacy is one concern. It had some pretty important consequences in Europe, at least, you know, we're very concerned with that issue, and it does have consequences. And I think it is kind of a voting with your wallet situation. And certainly the leaders of those companies are concerned with the ability to sell their products. I'm not sure, you know, it's equivalent to doing right by your constituency, which arguably politicians don't do either. But I mean, there is some form of accountability.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Leo, didn't you boycott Facebook over the privacy
issues?
Yeah,
and you're right. I mean, that's one way to do it. Harder, though, with Google. They feel like their infrastructure. Even if you use an iPhone, for instance, you're probably using a lot of Google services.
Mm.
I just feel like there's some of these people are a little bit more immune from that kind of pressure. Mm. Google's, by the way, quarter was fairly good as well. Revenue of $18.7 billion. That's 13% year-over-year growth. Mobile search revenue, once again, very big. Operating income, $4.7 billion using general accounting practices. You have to be able... This is part of your job, isn't this, Mark Million, to read these things?
Oh, yeah. Love GAAP. Love GAAP accounting.
GAAP and non-GAAP. Diluted EPS of 573 and 735, respectively, GAAP and non-GAAP. I don't know what any of that means. I don't care either. Apple TV's coming next week. We're going to run out and buy one?
I'm ordering tomorrow.
Monday. Now, is it midnight tonight? Midnight tomorrow? When is it?
I would assume midnight tonight. That's usually how they do it. I don't think they've gone that granular. But... Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, Apple TV I use every day.
I just got the new Roku 4, mm-hmm. 4K. Apple TV's not. It does have speech search, but I haven't really played with it much yet. Fire has speech search as well. That's... But the thing that's most interesting me on Apple TV is some of the things you can tell Siri to do in that are actually pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. They spend a lot of time on that. Amazon's voice search, I think, tends to prioritize Amazon services. Yeah. Whereas Apple's is actually, they don't necessarily prioritize iTunes. If you've got a Netflix account, they'll fold that
They
in.
They say it's cross-service.
Mm-hmm. It's very nice.
They haven't opened it to everyone yet, but I think that's going to be the key. First of all, when they open it to, you know, just more developers, because for now it's very limited. I'm guessing it's, you know, Netflix, Hulu, whatever. But the more important thing is the apps, right? That's the big game changer, not the search. The search is cool, but the apps is what's going to really, well, to have the potential to change things in the set-top box market.
I agree completely. I think the apps could potentially be huge based on what Apple has been able to do in a lot of different categories of devices. But your point about Siri is a good one. I mean, even on the iPhone, developers have been waiting for them to open up a Siri API since Siri came out. And they've shown no signs of doing that, going more of like the preferential treatment route.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's a very complicated problem to get voice search to open that up so any developer can build into it, and not, you know, turn it just into a mess of responses. But I think that once they get there, that'll potentially create a very interesting product.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I'm a utilitarian, and I just have the new circular Chromecast, which suits all my needs.
Sweet.
It's so good.
Love it.
It's so good. And I think the thing is that I am a person who uses my Chromecast for very specific things. You know, I can cast my tabs, or I can run Netflix, or if I wanted to, on it as sort of a backup device, because I also have a smart TV, and it often like doubles up on apps and devices. And also, you know, I think a lot of people are really pushing the idea that Apple TV, and to a lesser extent, but still an extent, the Amazon Fire TV is going to be used for gaming, which, put that mess away. No,
gaming on my Android TV, and it's just not, I mean, Crossy Road. It's not that compelling on a big screen.
It's
TV.
Just not.
This is where Roku is diverging. They were actually fairly early into emphasizing games and deals
they
with Angry Birds and others. Mm-hmm. Amazon had to deal with was it Flappy Bird? With
that's the last
Vietnamese
thing I
want
to do.
Flappy Bird guy.
And now Roku, we talked to their CEO. They said they've decided gaming is not the right application for us. They're pulling back significantly while Apple and Google are pushing much harder into it
Roku has to put faster processors in to make that work, more memory, more storage, and it brings the price up. And in fact, note how expensive Apple TV is even compared to the new Roku.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're putting the hardware in for 4K, which Apple TV did not do.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite ready.
It's still a little bit early for 4K. You know you're going to buy, if it's good.
If you buy a TV today, you're going to get a 4K TV. You can almost not get a 4K TV.
No, I could definitely not get a 4K market. TV.
No, I know you don't want a 4K TV, but I'm saying if you go into the store and you're looking at high-def TVs, you're almost always now looking at 4K TVs. That's how fast
that's moved.
Well, if you're not buying a TV this year, but I'm telling you, this year, if you're buying a TV, you will be buying a 4K TV.
What's the upgrade cycle on TV? So it's like 10 years, right?
Well, not that many people are in the stores, maybe, yeah.
I just want to get back to the gaming question.
All right.
Sorry, just want to go back to the gaming thing for just a second and say that one of the assets that Apple might have there is the controller, because the touch surface on the remote might provide a more adequate way of controlling your game than other set-top boxes have. And that might help push the gaming ecosystem on Apple TV forward a little bit, because the biggest issue with gaming on any device is the control scheme. Mm-hmm. And with this one, maybe a little bit better.
It's weird, though. They didn't include a controller. My Android TV, the NVIDIA Shield, that's the... You have to order a remote.
I mean, they were billing that more as a game NVIDIA.
Yeah. Amazon $30 controller you can buy. That's a gaming
Style. The Apple TV supports third-party controllers.
Right. Yeah.
And they sell, Apple stores now sell game control. I think if you're serious at all about gaming on Apple TV, you have to buy a remote.
I'm with Lauren, which is that you get a PlayStation.
Yeah, being a serious gamer on Apple TV is like
it's
an oxymoron. Oh man, what's your rig? Oh, I got a sick Apple TV.
I think we'll be talking again in a year, and there'll be a lot of cool games for it.
I got like a Bluetooth fight stick, man.
It's not going to be for serious gamers. That's for sure. I think that's established. Just like, honestly, an iPhone or an iPad is not for serious gamers either.
But there are a lot of people who game on them.
But when you game on these, you game on it because you're stuck in line at the DMV or the grocery store. You're not going to go home and
game. There are a lot of people who spend hours, especially kids, spend hours, like Minecraft on touchscreens is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah. And that's the thing. The big question is, are they going to manage to convert those people who play when they have free time? That's the way I usually explain it. Casual gamers are players who play when they have time to waste, and serious gamers are gamers who make time to play games, right? And are they going to convert one into the other? And the big thing is, if they manage to do that, developers are going to be interested, because for some reason, psychologically, I'm pretty sure you're going to be able to sell a game that plays on your TV for, you know, $4, $5, $7 when that's totally unacceptable on your phone. Mm-hmm. And if some people think, well, I'm playing on my phone already, I might check out that thing that they're making commercials for on my TV, there might be an intermediate market that's going to make a lot more money to the developers. It's a big if.
Here is video from Clash Con, the Clash of Clans conference, which is going on right now. People playing Clash of Clans. Let me see if I can find.
Introducing. This is remarkable. This is like the faux esports. You know, like, okay, I know I don't look it, but I love esports so much.
Do you watch esports?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I watch.
Would
esports.
You watch somebody playing this game?
No, I wouldn't, because I watch Dota and League of Legends.
Ah, now we're talking. This is not as fast moving as League of Legends.
It's not only that, but it's like tic tac toe versus I don't know, like chess, basically. Like Dota and other MOBAs require so much of a vast amount of knowledge and like different matchups and items and all this stuff. Like, you need to practically take a college course in order to understand all of the schema and aspects that go into MOBAs. And here it's just like, throw your guys at the thing, hit the wall, explode it.
Well, that's mobile gaming, right? That's the thing. This is not anywhere in the same league, so to speak.
Which is interesting, right? Because when you look at something like this, you think like, okay, well, this is what people like what Apple and what Amazon have in mind when they're putting forth their gaming experiences on a television, which is completely different from the way that I grew up as a gamer. You know, I have four brothers and sisters, and we had an N64, and you better be good because you didn't want to be the fifth person that was out and not able to play the game, which is how it worked. You got your controller taken away from you and given to the other person. You've lost your privilege. They get to play now. So we were really serious about it, but it's one of those situations where you look at this experience and you think to yourself, like, okay, well, if we're looking at modern gaming as it is now, you have this, but then you have, you know, Sony and Microsoft, and you have Oculus, and you have Valve, and you have all these companies that are pushing into this other direction. And I sort of wonder whether or not this is actually going to be a good, fully realized big screen experience rather than just kind of like a novelty. Like, oh yeah, I can definitely play Crossy Road on my Fire TV, but I'm not going to like sit down for hours and like
I'm agreeing with you. I'm nothing against Clash of Clans. We have a Twit clan and I've been very active in Clash of Clans, but it's mobile gaming is not real gaming in like you would sit down in the living room gaming.
You can spend a lot of time on mobile. I mean, they've got all the Final Fantasy games on there now. Yeah, you can spend like 40 hours.
No, they cut out all the good stuff out of Final Fantasy VII. I'm not buying that. No.
Oh, did they?
I'm going to take a 3-week break when Fallout 4 comes out. I'm not coming in to work. That's it. I'm going home.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
But you know, I feel I have to defend Clash of Clans a little bit.
No, I love Clash of Clans.
Oh, you got the Pip-Boy edition. That's pretty badass, I have to say.
That's where you put your smartphone in a special bracelet on your wrist so you can play Fallout and use the Pip-Boy heads-up display.
I don't know. I'm going to finally get Uncharted.
That's a great game.
I have not started Uncharted. They just made the remastered Nathan Drake collection. Yeah. I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do the new Uncharted once it comes out.
Oh, my God. You've never played Uncharted?
I know. At all? Oh, being in college and poor. It's one of those situations where it was like food or Uncharted, and I had to pick.
You know what?
Food.
Just play the second one because the first one is and then jump into the fourth one because if you do all of them, you're going to get Uncharted hangover.
I know.
And you're not going to appreciate
that. Sounds painful.
I did play all the way through patiently through Mass Effect 2, but was told not to play Mass Effect 1.
Wow.
And 3. Yeah, I'm a paragon.
Wow. Far Cry's pretty good. I like Far Cry. The new Far Cry's pretty fun. One of the things Apple TV does do that I'm very excited about is you can, and maybe it's just because I'm an old man, but you can say when you're watching a show, what did he just say? And Siri will skip back 15 seconds, turn on closed captioning, replay that segment.
That's pretty cool. I've had that. I've definitely had those experiences.
You could say play from beginning. You could say turn on closed captioning. You could say fast forward 2 minutes. I don't know why you'd want to do that.
Who's winning the Cubs game?
Yeah, that's kind of, they should change that. That's
not the Cubs.
The low-key burn now.
Yeah. What did he just say? I love that. Turn on enhanced speech. Who directed this movie? I think the idea of having a smart agent in your TV might be a killer app. Less so the gaming, but I think that might be a killer app.
Well, this is
Go ahead. Sorry. Oh, thank you. That's what Steve Jobs was saying apparently on his deathbed, you know, when he said he's cracked it. I've had a pretty revelatory experience a few years ago. I hadn't used a TV for, I think, 10 or 15 years. And then I moved and I bought a big TV and I thought, yay, I'm going to buy, you know, a TV and I'm going to have a cable box and it's going to be really different from what it was 15 years ago. And good Lord, it wasn't. Oh, it was horrible.
It's worse. So 15 years ago, at least you had TiVo, right? And now you got a DVR from your cable company. I don't know what it's like in France, but it's horrible here.
It is terrible. But the main thing is that now that we have all of those services that are completely independent from one another, you never know where what you want to watch is or if it is available. You can go to the Netflix app. You can go. And that's where the Siri search is really killer. It's that you just say what you want to watch and it tells you if it is available and if it is where and how much, you know, if you can buy it. Or that is definitely a significant improvement on the TV UI that I don't think many other services or devices offer.
Midnight.
I guess the Fire TV, but
I'll be up at midnight.
The Fire TV is actually interesting as well, because I think that they want to really do that with Alexa and doing Alexa integration, which isn't currently available now. Like
as far
Amazon
as I'm
Fire
concerned,
TV.
I want Alexa everywhere.
Yeah.
I want her in my Sonos. I want her everywhere.
Yeah, and they're really working on integrating a lot of what Alexa does in the Echo into the Fire TV without it being actively listening, which I know is really hinky for some people. They don't like the idea that their machine is constantly listening to them. You actually do have to push a button.
So what? Come on.
I don't want Alexa listening to me all the time.
She's not. The hardware is listening for you to say that word. And then she listens. Oh, come on. What could possibly go wrong?
I don't know. I'll craft my tinfoil hat.
You can write the prologue to 1984.
It is, you know, of course, that was the whole thing. And I think that's why people are paranoid, because the TV screens in 1984, not only could you watch them, they could watch you.
Yeah.
But that really, that's fiction. This is not practical.
Mm-hmm. Do you use Facebook, Lauren?
Yes. I do.
Oh, well, there you go.
But it's different. Facebook isn't... There is a difference between the idea of having a fully actively listening system and people being able to have access, whether front door or back door access to your
information. It'd be kind of cool, though. If you worked at the NSA, you could say, I'm kind of bored. Turn on Lauren's Alexa. Let's hear what she's saying.
Yeah, they're going to like catch me like singing K-pop.
Exactly.
Making
it's
eggs.
It's not like you're plotting to take over the government. What are you going to hear? Nothing.
A lot of my garbage ideas I don't tell other people.
Stuff you don't want them to hear, I admit. But nothing that they are going to be interested in.
It's a very good argument for a police state, Leo. Yeah, I'm convinced.
Speaking of police states, Apple has told a U.S. court that it is not possible for us to unlock new iPhones. We don't have a back door. They laid out a brief on Monday after a federal magistrate in Brooklyn asked Apple, he was weighing a U.S. Department of Justice request to force Apple to help access a iPhone seized during an investigation. In the brief, Apple said that for 90% of its devices, anything running iOS 8 or higher, we cannot. We strengthen encryption methods. We have no way of unlocking that phone. Department of Justice says... Too bad, you better come up with a way. And that is the battle that's going on. Not listening in on your Alexa. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say the name out loud because people listening to the show on their Echoes are annoyed right now. I've said it quite a few times.
So is this a case of... I was wondering if they were talking about iOS 7 when they said, well, you have to. Or if they're just saying, well... you have to for iOS 8 or iOS 9, in which case it's like Apple might answer, I don't think you're listening. We cannot do it.
Well, DOJ says you may not, but you better figure out a way, because you own the software. Apple, in its license agreement, says the software is not sold to you, but is licensed to you. And so the Justice Department replied to Apple's filing, saying Apple designed, manufactured, and sold the phone that is subject to the search warrant. But that's only the beginning of their relationship with the phone. Apple writes and owns the software, and this software is thwarting the execution of the warrant. So the threat is, we're going to come after you, Apple, because this is your software that's getting in the way of our investigation.
Yeah, this is not the first time this has happened. And usually the response is that a company like Skype went and installed a backdoor so the governments could get in.
Most companies just... If you're going to do business in the United States, you're going to end up doing what the U.S. Law enforcement and courts tell you to do.
They've been so forceful in their, you know, team. Basically, Tim Cook's entire, you know, a third of his communication strategy in the past few months has been, we are not Google. We cannot spy on you. Your privacy is important.
Yeah.
Do you think
it's not
they would cave? We were saying they have too much power and they're accountable to no one.
Right.
I think in this instance, it might be a case where they actively and publicly fight an injunction like this.
Twitter's done that. There are companies that have done that very actively. And I think Apple realizes this is a business issue for them. That they've been, as you say, Patrick, they've been selling this privacy and security. It'll be interesting. I think when it comes down to, at least in the United States, I don't care how big the company is, eventually you're going to have to do what the laws say you have to do, right?
Well, also at some point your software comes into contact with a server or a cloud or something, and that information is seized one way or another, which is also the difficult thing. I mean,
right,
you see
the downstream wiretapping outside. Yeah,
exactly. And although Apple, I mean, for the most part, I mean, you have to think of the instances in which actually actively unlocking a phone would be beneficial to an investigation that wouldn't otherwise be. I mean, I guess it's just covering your bases. But I mean, if you already have access to email, Facebook,
there's lots of other ways.
All these other things. Yeah. Then how much of an impact would or could a device that is unlocked make? Something that I guess really isn't quantified or qualified in these hearings with the DOJ, as far as I can tell.
The interesting thing about this is I think a lot of these companies double deal. They say very publicly, oh, no, we're protecting your privacy. But then when it comes to behind the scenes lobbying, they may not do that. And case in point is this latest bill, which was just passed in the Senate, CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. In public, Google and Apple and Facebook and Dropbox and Twitter all wanted to stop CISA. They made a big noise about how much they hated CISA. But there's some evidence that behind the scenes, some of these companies might have been lobbying for CISA to pass. One of the reasons they might want it to pass, the CISA allows companies to share data about security issues with each other, but also with the U.S. government. The theory is that as we're getting more and more cyber attacks, the better the information sharing is, the safer everybody is. But of course, people are concerned that this will also allow companies, or in fact force companies, to share private information about its users with law enforcement. And one of the reasons it's thought that Facebook and others might like this bill is because it would eliminate any liability they might have for revealing that private information to law enforcement. Anyway, the bill has been passed. The president's indicated he will sign it. I guess it's a done deal. It's not. If you want to continue to fight it, you can go to fightforthefuture.org and write your member of Congress. But I think it's a done deal.
Well, here, that would be Dianne Feinstein.
Who invented the bill.
Yeah, she'll have none of it. So write to another congressman, please. Yeah,
thank you. So it was on October 23rd, 2001, that Apple announced the iPod. Steve Jobs up on the stage talking about 5 gigabytes
Can you get me my original iPod? It's in the case back there. Remember the FireWire connection? 1,000 songs in your pocket.
Only worked on a Mac.
Only worked on a Mac. Remember those days? So Mac rumors, apparently, they kept their discussion about the original iPod alive on the Mac rumors site. And there it is. Here's the look at that.
Ooh, what a paperweight.
I know. FireWire port on the top. The hold button. An actual spinning click wheel. Mm-hmm. Isn't that fun? You know what? If we could find a FireWire cable, I think we could probably power it up and see what Leo was listening to in 2001.
Will Smith's Will 2K?
Yeah. I'm moving to Miami. Bienvenido a Miami. I think that actually is on there.
That was on Big Willie Style.
Oh,
but...
sorry. Wow.
You're close.
I should never brought a knife to a rap fight.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, it's fun to read these posts because the internet hasn't changed much. Elite Mac Orr says, I poop, I cry. I was so hoping for something more. Weezer X6 X80, great. Just what the world needs. Another freaking MP3 player. Go, Steve. Where's the Newton?
Where's the Newton?
Where's the Newton? Here's one from...
I think the best one...
Yeah, you've read these.
Yeah.
Pick your best.
I think it's the one you were going to read, but it's one from a gentleman called Pants,
yes,
or a lady, who says,
more likely,
why don't you spend a little more time sorting out your pathetically expensive and crap server lineup? Or are you really aiming to become a glorified consumer gimmicks firm?
Well, there you have it. Like,
well, actually, gimmicks, glorified consumer gimmicks firm
Not
sounds
such a
great
business, come to think of it. And whatever happened to that expensive server line? Bye-bye. It's certainly not big bottom line. What a load of tripe. An MP3 player with a hard drive. How original. There are a few people, to be fair, who say, oh, this is so exciting. $400 for an MP3 player? I call it the Cube 2.0. It won't sell. It'll be killed off in a short time. It's not really functional.
Can I have a PDA?
I have to say I didn't. They wanted Newtons. Half of those of the people on the thread want Newtons. I have to say I didn't like the first iPod. I had a tiny, like 2 inches by 2 inches MP3 player from Panasonic that held, I don't know, maybe 128 megabytes. And I loved that thing. It was super small. So the iPod was too big for me.
The reality distortion field is starting to warp Steve's mind if he thinks for 1 second that this thing is going to take off. There's no future in iPods. Isn't that funny? There are a few people who understood it, but most of the people were very disappointed. And that just shows you, really, in a way, this in many ways is a tribute to Steve Jobs. The guy did not pay attention to what people asked for. He did what he thought was the right thing to do. And it turned out more often than not in every respect, but more often than not, he was absolutely right.
Well, and I think it's important to understand the fact that, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call the original iPod like the one that had the biggest impact. I always think of the iPod mini. Perhaps that's dating myself a little bit because I wasn't allowed to, my mom told me no with the iPod, but she was like, iPod mini, that's the right price.
Yeah. No, in fact, that's the one my kids got. Their first iPods were the iPod Mini.
19.
Yeah, that was the highest selling one at its time.
And the Nano after that was very big. And iTunes, of course. And iTunes on Windows was what put the iPod on the map, which was something Steve Jobs fought for a long time but eventually gave in on. Let's take a break. Come back with more. We are talking about tech. I want to talk about YouTube Red, the new YouTube subscription channel that launches on Wednesday. A $1 billion funding round, not just for Magic Leap, but also for Uber. This is not valuing them. This is the new unicorn. Not valued at $1 billion. Give us $1 billion. Uber will now be valued, if they raise this money, which I think they will, at something like $50 billion. And they still haven't made any money, have they? There's no profit at all in Uber. I don't think so. Certainly not in Magic Leap. Not that I'm laughing or anything. And a real tech hero, Jack Dorsey, gives back his Twitter stock, at least part of it, to his employees. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. I'm a big Audible fan. I don't think it's a surprise. I am listening to audiobooks all the time. We're all excited about this new Sarah Vowell book. This is one that Andy Inoko recommended. Sarah Vowell, who's a contributor to This American Life, has this wonderful, quirky voice, has written a book about the Marquis de Lafayette. You've heard of him, right, Patrick?
Of course.
Lafayette, I am here. He is the Frenchman, the 20-something Frenchman, who helped win the Revolutionary War for America. And she's apparently written, I don't know what it is, a biography? A humorous and insightful portrait of the famed Frenchman. And listen to the people that are reading this with her. John Slattery, the good-looking guy on Mad Men, you know, the white-haired guy on Mad Men. Fred Armisen from Saturday Night Live. John Hodgman, we all love John Hodgman. And more, this sounds like an amazing book. Nick Offerman, the guy with a mustache, is also in this. Is this on Audible now? Oh, I didn't know it. Do you know the Night Vale podcast? Welcome to Night Vale is now an Audible book. They released, let me just look this up. This is awesome. So the deal is I'm going to get you two books. So there's two books you might want to get right there. If you listen to the Night Vale podcast, the novel of the Night Vale podcast is now out. Welcome to Night Vale by Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, based on the podcast. I wonder who narrates it. Is Cecil Baldwin the announcer on it? So he's in this.
You know how it is. Imagine a 15-year-old boy. Nope, that was not right at all. Try again.
I don't. Oh, look, my you've got my iPod fired up. Holy cow. I could play Audible books on the current iPod. In fact, one of the best things about Audible is it works on everything, your iPhone, your Android device, your Windows phone, your Mac, your PC. You can even listen on the web. So Audible, which is so cool, now works on my Chromebook. I am so thrilled. 180,000 titles. This is my Audible library. I'm just finishing now The Three-Body Problem, an amazing science fiction trilogy that just came out of China. Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves is probably next on my list. I'm a huge Neal Stephenson fan. Felicia Day's book is out on Audible. Of course, she narrates it along with a foreword by Joss Whedon, who all narrates his foreword. There's so much good stuff. Fiction, nonfiction, science fiction. The new Ernie Cline, Armada, narrated, of course, by Will Wheaton. He's the guy that did Ready Player One. The hardest thing about having an Audible subscription is, and you see I have two credits available, picking two books. I love it. I've got so many great books available, and you could too. Go to audible.com/twit, the number two. You're going to be signing up for the Platinum account. That's two books a month, but your first month is free. You cancel any time in that first 30 days. You'll pay nothing, but your two books are yours to keep forever. You also get the Daily Digest of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. audible.com/twit and the number two. If you have seen the movie The Martian but you haven't read the book, please do yourself a favor. If you haven't seen the movie, read the book first. So much good stuff at Audible. audible.com/twit2. Two books free. Do you think there's any Will Smith on here? Let's see.
Browse. Was recently played.
What? Oh, is there a recent? Is there a recent? No, that's late. Maybe let's look.
I don't know. Again, like I said,
yeah. No, they don't have. That's still to come. This is a 14-year-old device. Let's browse artists. 50 Ooh, Cent.
50 Cent. Oh wow.
AC/DC, Aerosmith. I have a little Alanis, but remember this was 2000.
Yeah,
that's okay. Let's see if I'll go down to the W's. Zombie Nation.
Oh, wow.
Weird Al. Walt Disney. That's my kids. That's not me. They've grown up. I don't see any Will Smith.
But you do have Snap on there, so that's kind of okay.
Really? I get points for Snap?
The Power.
Yeah, that's exactly the song.
Yeah.
The Power.
From Jock Jams Volume 8.
It's from Jock Jams Volume 8. You got it.
Jock Jams was it. Jock Jams is number one.
You guys
Wednesday,
know Jock Jams?
Yes.
Awesome. Queen Latifah, Outkast. Wait a minute. You actually said we could listen to something.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I don't know if this fits. The standards have changed. Little Nelly. You want to hear some Nelly?
Oh, my gosh. Which one?
Air Force Ones. I saw Nelly performing Air Force Ones right across the street.
Oh, that must have been cool.
It was.
I've seen a show there. That's a good venue.
Listen, that still works.
It does.
That's the iPod playing.
Sound quality leaves something to be desired.
Well, that's not the iPod's fault. I don't think that's probably the, the hookup. I got the hookup.
I'm gonna...
Is this bringing back memories? You were eight?
I was not eight. Thank you. I wasn't 8 years old. I was...
We even got the lights. Here, let me play it some more.
I was in the seventh grade. And every kid on, like, that was how you differentiated yourself. Like, on,
what
like, whatever the black top.
Yeah.
No, is if you knew all the words to Air Force Ones.
I should just give you this. There it is, the original iPod. And it still works 14 years later. That is kind of amazing. I don't know if that's my first or if that's just something I have had for a while. Or I really don't know the provenance of this. Okay. What did I say I was going to talk about? I forgot.
YouTube Red.
You want to talk about YouTube Red?
Sure.
I don't understand what that's what
yes,
this,
please.
What's going on with YouTube Red. So I want somebody to explain to me. I think ESPN doesn't understand either. They've been shutting their videos down and putting them back up. So starting Wednesday, YouTube, if you go to youtube.com/red, you can learn all about it. YouTube is going to launch a subscription tier, $10 a month. You'll be able to watch YouTube videos without ads, YouTube music videos without ads, and you'll get a subscription to Google Music. Or the other way around. I have a subscription to Google Music, so I will get ad-free YouTube as well. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to save songs offline and videos offline. That's something YouTube's always blocked. There have been third-party apps that do that. You'll be able to play them in the background. It's really an interesting play, but I wonder who's going to pay $10 a month for YouTube videos without ads?
Potentially everybody who pays for Spotify and Apple Music. And
well, that's the thing. I buy Google Music. That's a great service. And so I'm getting this for free. So that I would do. You think that's what people will say is, well, I want the music.
So I think that this is one of those situations where there's a little bit of a generational hitch attached to the new ad-free YouTube.
Okay.
Specifically,
that was a dog whistle. What you just did there.
That was directed right at you.
It was right at me.
It's actually even.
You mean there are some people too old to get what this is all about?
I'm too old to get what this is all about. What I mean to say is that the bulk of loyal YouTube subscribers to people like PewDiePie or Bethany Mota or Michelle Phan, people who have really made millions.
The people who watch PewDiePie are 12 years old.
Yeah.
They are not going to spend $10 a month. They don't have $10 a month. That's their whole allowance.
So that's the issue, right? Is that they're essentially establishing this channel that's going to bring people like Toby Turner into the original content space. It's going to be, you know, YouTube is going to back this content. And, you know, we have all these great creators that have these millions of followers. But are those, you know, are those followers the same people who have that kind of like
right
paper route money to spend, I guess,
this
is really
YouTube
what I want to know.
YouTube has been doing this all along, which is they don't want to be the 12-year-old channel. They really want to be the new TV. And so when they had they were giving people $1 million, $2 million to do YouTube channels. You know, Shaq got a YouTube channel, and that was a miserable flop. They really want to create premium content to replace television.
And that's expected to be a part of this subscription service,
right?
Is that they'll have exclusives that are only available if you're a subscriber, much like Netflix has House of Cards and Daredevil and a bunch of other very popular shows. YouTube won't necessarily go the Netflix route and do high quality Hollywood style.
But there
films,
is money to do that, I think. I mean, I think they're playing.
There's money
stuff
to do it, but
yeah.
I don't. At least what we've seen, they're not looking to take on Netflix directly and create a Netflix copycat. I mean, they will pay money to commission exclusive videos that look and feel more like what you're used to with YouTube and not sort of hour-long adult dramas.
Now, Patrick, this is U.S. only.
Sorry.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But would you like to do this? Would you do this if you could?
Yeah. I think I would. I've transitioned from, basically, I used to watch a lot of video podcasts, and now all the video I watch is on YouTube. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of valuable content, not just for 12-year-olds. You're totally right. PewDiePie's audience is, you know, 12-year-old boys and 14-year-old girls. But it's not just that. I think YouTube is in a runt, and they have a problem with revenue. The big problem on YouTube is that creators don't make enough money to make a decent living, because the ad revenue has become so low. You know, it's always been very low, but with the ad blocking and everything, it's impossible for people who aren't basically either students or unemployed to make a living on YouTube, because it takes too much time, it takes too much energy, and it eats up your life. And people are, with respectable followings, are not making the amount of money that makes their activity sustainable on the long term. So I think what they're doing is basically kickstarting a longer process. First of all, by giving a lot of people lots of different reasons to get that subscription. It's not just removing the ads, it's the music and the ability to, you know, they've artificially constrained the app so that it couldn't play in the backgrounds and stuff like that. And I would like to have that ability, and the exclusive content. It's a big package. And once that happens, not only do people provide $10 a month to YouTube, which is an enormous amount, the equivalent to an enormous amount of ads watched. So the revenue per user would be significant for those who choose to do that. But also it removes a little bit of ad inventory, and potentially could raise the ad price a little bit and make even the CPM on ad-supported content a little bit higher. And I think they don't have a choice. They have to provide that option, because the revenue from ad only is not sustainable in the long run. It's just, they, even if it doesn't work out in the first year or two, they have to provide that option. And maybe if it's not good enough, you know, if they don't get it, the numbers to affect their revenue, they can then introduce, you know, a 3 months or yearly deal that is going to make it cheaper, that people are then more likely to go for. So I think it's a very important play for YouTube, and it's actually, I would say, platform defining.
You're a creator. You, in fact, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, Patrick, you are now a full-time podcaster, and that's because of Patreon. You have a model. Jack Conte, who founded Patreon, is quoted in this article on The Verge. He said he doesn't think Red will bring about any improvements for creators. Quote, subscription. By the way, Jack was on here a couple of weeks ago. He said one of the main reasons I created Patreon is because Pomplamoose, the wonderful music that he and his girlfriend Natalie Dawn make, would get 1 million views on a Pomplamoose video that cost them $6,000 to make and make $1,500 in ad revenue from YouTube. It wasn't a viable model. So he created Patreon so that viewers could support the artist directly. He says subscription services are great for consumers. Pay $10, have any song or video in your pocket whenever you want. But for the creators, there's still way too much of a middleman. He said, my art might be worth $10 to a super fan, but if she's listening on Spotify, even with a subscription, I'm still only getting pennies every time she interacts with what I've made. Patreon is, of course, a better model if you want to support creators. But YouTube is where the audience is.
The audience, I mean, Patreon is for engaged audiences,
right?
And it's a very small percentage of your audience that is actually going to go and support you on Patreon. For me, for example, I have a bi-monthly show, and it's supported by about 1,000 people out of a much wider audience. And they give about, you know, $2.50 to $3 per episode. And that's with additional revenue on the side, that's roughly enough to make an okay living. I don't think that's the audience that YouTube is going to go after. I think what they're hoping is going to happen is that it's going to make, currently on YouTube, if you don't have, you know, at least 500,000 to 1 million subscribers to watch your videos, you're probably not going to be making a good living. Right. And so, even then, I'm not sure it's decent.
The vast majority of YouTube creators are just not making money. They're doing it for promotional reason or something else.
I think YouTube always trots out
PewDiePie and Michelle Phan because they are making millions, but they're the exception, I think.
I think those people are making enough money to live on if they're students living in their parents' basement. Or, you know, it's ironic. But and I think what they're trying to do is to get that threshold where you can make a living out of it, not on Patreon level where you can make a living out of a few thousand, you know, people that support you, but maybe a few tens of thousands people, you know, watching and subscribing, maybe 100,000, and a portion of those people are going to go and subscribe to YouTube, and that's going to raise your revenue level.
There's a lot of unknowns about YouTube Red. We don't know how they divide the $10 up. Is it based on views? Am I going to get more money from YouTube Red than I would have gotten from ads embedded on my content? We personally, Twit, we don't know exactly what's going to happen to us. The current thinking is nothing because our ads are interstitial. We don't turn on monetization on our – we've been told we can't turn on monetization on our shows, our full shows, because they have their own ads. And I don't think that YouTube Red will hide our shows. But I think even ESPN is confused because they've been taking shows down and putting them back up. It's not obvious what's going to happen at all. And it could be that all of a sudden, come Wednesday – none of our shows with advertising, our own advertising, like this show, will be visible on YouTube. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, the intricate thing about the ESPN situation is the fact that ESPN, a lot of ESPN's content is licensed from somewhere else. It's licensed from the NFL or the MLB or the NBA. And those have separate licensing deals, which is why you saw that whole... I'd like to think that it's connected, but I'm, you know, unsure. I don't get to see fully what's behind the curtain over at ESPN. But it's kind of the same issue when you look at the fact that they, you know, had to do DCMA takedowns over.
Is it related to YouTube Red or just coincidental?
I think the timing might be coincidental, but it also shows sort of the tenuous agreements that ESPN might have in sort of creating and producing content that is licensed or has specific deals in terms of sharing for these, you know, these big sports leagues. You know, like what happens when you have a viral NFL video that ESPN is running, but ESPN is using for something like YouTube Red. Does that violate the deal with the NFL? Does YouTube have to make the contract with the NFL directly? You know, all of a sudden you start to see these things where it's like if you have this sort of this old media, how that interacts with the way that YouTube Red is established is really not clear because the only thing that YouTube is really talking about are these like original shows that they're working on and sort of this expansion or kind of the gussied up version of what you normally see from YouTubers.
What do you think, Mark? What do you think YouTube's goal is here with Red? Is this just an experiment, or is this YouTube really trying to reinvent itself?
I think it's probably more about the music. They've been trying to do a subscription music service for a year, and they've had...
YouTube Music Key, right?
Yeah, for at least a year, and they've been testing it. They apparently either haven't been able to get the rights done or haven't been able to find a way to make the service work, and now... they're folding music together with all of the rest of YouTube.
It's really about the music, you think?
I think it's really about... I think that's where...
I look at my
That's
son.
Where there's an established market for
it. He doesn't have a subscription to any of this stuff. He just watches YouTube music videos.
And a lot of kids do that.
On the playlist all the time. That's his music right there. And they have... You know, he's in college. He's 23. They have a... They put up a big screen and they just let it run all day. Mm-hmm. That's their music.
And if you're a consumer who's trying to weigh between Spotify or Apple Music or YouTube, which presumably has pretty much the same catalog, plus if you're going on an airplane, you can save some videos to watch from the plane along with all of your music for the same price.
Yeah, I actually kinda like that, yeah.
Unless you're a fan of Prince, and then you're left out in the cold.
Prince, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones.
That might change with a subscription, you know, a subscription service that actually works and brings in a lot of money. But I think music is important. I think it's a portion of what YouTube could become if it managed to make decent money for its creators. All in all, you know, music is not an enormous industry compared to everything that we have in the tech world. I think, you know, TV is not going away, but it's kind of dwindling a little bit. It could be replaced by IPTV in a sense in the next few years. And YouTube has done a great job at sort of moving from the funny cat on a skateboard video image it had, but it's not quite a place where people go for actual content. It's been getting to interesting videos. I think, I don't know if you guys know channels like Crash Course of, or PBS Spacetime or things like that, that are super interesting, super well done, high quality content. But I think it could go even further. And in order to do that, they need to raise revenue for the creators. And the potential, I really think, far exceeds music alone.
So PBS Spacetime is a YouTube channel from PBS.
Mm-hmm. Discovery Network also has DNews, which is partially based on their Revision 3 acquisition.
I look at the views on PBS Spacetime, which, you know, is great content. 180,000, 275,000.
Go to Crash Course.
That's not money that would make any difference to me, let alone YouTube. I mean, there's not bad views, maybe, but this is a, in other words, I'm saying this is a promotional vehicle for PBS. This is not, they're not trying to make the money back. Crash Course, huh? How much, what is that all about?
You're thinking it's the same kind of programming. They have a lot more videos. They have it's the Green Brothers.
Yeah, I love them. Yeah,
but yeah,
but the same really great thing. They're 45,000, 85,000 views. Again, this is you do this pro bono. I'm sure YouTube loves them. But
they're crowdfunded. They're Patreon. Okay, but you're thinking in ads terms. I think if you start getting people to subscribe for these kinds of shows and who watch these kinds of shows, I think it shifts the balance a little bit.
Some of these are pretty good. John Green's world history views. We're talking 2 million, 1 million, it's 1 million. Now, that's taken him a year, but these are not insignificant. So some are bigger than others, obviously. Chemistry.
And those are timeless content. You can go back and watch them forever. And the catalog, the back catalog on YouTube is actually what makes the most money.
Right.
So,
golly, though, is this how kids are learning U.S. history now, is watching a video on YouTube?
I think they still have school.
Well, you got to think that there's a reason why there's a million and a half views on this. This is kids going here to either supplement their school, or maybe even this is being shown at school.
I think that also there's a test tomorrow and somebody did a study.
Crash Course in U.S. History.
Absolutely. And honestly,
and I think
Sulu
is as important as Thomas Alva Edison. Don't you?
that's the brilliance of this channel specifically.
Uh-huh. That was a test to see if you were paying attention.
I'm paying attention to the When is Thanksgiving video. Yeah. Which I'm sure they got a million hits just by saying When is Thanksgiving for people who are Googling.
What an SEO boon. What is Thanksgiving?
Oh, what time is the Super Bowl?
Because I ask that all the time. When is Thanksgiving? Yeah. School is where you go to watch YouTube, says Joel H. in our chat room. That may be true. Mm-hmm. I think we're in an interesting world where the educators of the next generation may be coming from YouTube, not from the classroom. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Could be a good thing. I mean, Salman Khan, I trust him.
Yeah, the whole MOOC thing has kind of gone out of fashion a little bit.
Has it?
Yeah. And no more MOOCs? Sebastian Thrun has kind of pulled back a little bit on Udacity.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. It's still a great
concept.
Is that
a bubble?
I think there's a little bit of a MOOC bubble. A little MOOC, little MOOC bubble.
The problem is the name MOOC.
Yeah.
Very possible. But the MOOCs were thought of by teachers. If you look at things like Crash Course, I'm sure there are a lot of them, but they are very fast 10 minutes videos made with humor in the way that YouTube videos work. So they were conceived from a YouTuber's point of view and a YouTube audience point of view, and I think that's why they're working.
The other problem, of course, is that YouTube seems to be forcing content creators to sign the red deal. Like, you don't have a choice. If you
sign on or your videos disappear.
Yeah. But now, we never got anything like that because we're not partners. So are we partners? I don't even know what we are.
No, I think everyone has to sign.
I think the deal is unless you choose to hide your videos, they will be a part of the service and you tacitly agree to be on board with Red.
Okay. Well, I'll find out when I get that big check. This is cool. Halo 5, you excited? You gonna take the day off to play Halo 5, Lauren? No, you're not a Halo player.
I'm not really a Halo player for a lot of complicated reasons that I will not go into right now.
You once had a boyfriend who looked a little like Master Chief, and now, ever since, you just can't...
You know, when you're in a bar and you just look across the room and somebody is in full Master Chief armor, you tell me if you can resist that.
That'll traumatize you.
You tell me.
Right there.
Well, it's interesting because I believe... that Halo 5 is by the same development team that did Halo 4, if I'm not mistaken.
343 Industries, owned wholly by Microsoft.
Yes. Which I guess some people liked Halo 4, although at the same time, that's how Cortana came into existence in a lot of ways. So you sort of see...
Cortana comes from Halo, right?
Yeah, Cortana comes from Halo. So I think that... Halo 5 should be good, but I don't know if people are finished playing Destiny. Last time I checked, they're all still on that.
Destiny's good. I like that. Yeah. What time is it in Sydney right now?
I bet there's a YouTube video for that.
It's 10 in the morning tonight. I've always been very jealous of people who live in Sydney, but tonight, if you're in Sydney, look up above the skies. Microsoft is going to launch Halo 5 Guardians around 8 o'clock on Monday night by projecting on the sky the first 15 minutes of the game, first 10 minutes of the game. It's a 20,000-square-foot screen, in effect.
Wow.
And the screen will... Maybe there is a screen. I don't know what it is. The screen will make its... Must be a screen. Will make its way from Sydney's northern suburbs toward Coogee and back.
You know, I used to work for Blizzard Entertainment until a year ago, and we used to have brainstorming sessions on, you know, with the PR team. I used to work in PR, and we used to have sessions where we would try and brainstorm some kind of idea to launch the game. Bravo, Microsoft.
Bravo.
That is actually a good one.
Bravo. We have many viewers in Sydney. Please send us a video if you...
I think you're going to have a highly produced video from Microsoft available next day.
I bet you're right. Facebook is putting its social search global. If you've ever published publicly on Facebook, get ready because your posts will now be searchable. 2 trillion posts are being indexed. I haven't used this yet. Have you? Am I going to be able to Google Facebook content as well, which has always been blocked? What does this mean?
I think it means you're going to be able to Facebook Google content.
Oh, Lord.
Facebook Google content.
Oh, Lord.
It's all very confusing. Facebook has rebooted their search efforts several times. You remember they came out
the social graph and that whole...
Yeah, how you'd be able
all
to...
All my friends who live in New York City who
exactly.
like pizza.
That's still in there, but they're moving away from that a little bit to make it more of a... Just type in a keyword, kind of like a Google-type search engine. And I guess now they'll have all the public posts available. But I don't know if a lot of people really post stuff publicly like they do on Twitter. Maybe they do
by accident. A lot of pages do,
I post everything publicly. Yeah, why not?
Hey...
I don't
but,
post at all.
You don't post the at business all? Pages are going to be included in that, right? And all of that is public. So I think that's a significant amount of content.
Yeah, but I don't know. Do a lot of people want to search through like press releases? That's basically what it is. Very short companies posting media material.
Yeah, I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that Facebook wants people to connect with public figures in the way that they're sort of promoting their live streaming and sort of all of this engagement surrounding Facebook subscribers. I know as someone who tried to get Facebook verified recently and was told that I don't post publicly enough in order to be... I know. Although Google tells me I'm the only Lauren Hawkinson in the world. So like there's no fake...
Oh, that's nice.
I know. It's great for SEO.
Are your parents planning ahead?
I think that they were given the name. Hawkinson, which is cool. Thanks.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, thanks, Sweden. But actually what happens is that...
look at that. It does have live... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I did tell you we're a little ADD.
Squirrel.
Here.
Thanks. Yeah, squirrel. Shiny foil.
Look, see, so I did the 360 video, right? And now, if you show it on your Android phone on Facebook, you can move the phone around.
Oh.
That's such a cool looking phone, that Samsung.
That'll make you nauseous real quick. Look at that.
Yeah, but I think that what Facebook is trying to do is really get people to connect more with their public figures who want to use Facebook as a way to connect with subscribers and
Moments,
followers.
That's what Moments is all about, right? Because they allowed us, verify people, I'm sorry.
I know.
To post live video.
Yeah, and I just don't. I mean, I still come from that space where Facebook to me is like a private network.
Right.
Where it's, you know, it's stuff where, you know, I get to see pictures, you know, from my, you know, my niece's Halloween costume.
You could post 360 degree video of your life. That's I'm looking at it on Facebook.
I can post 360 degree video of me singing K-pop and making eggs for sure.
You know how hot you would, how popular you would be? You would be huge.
Well, you know, actually, I think
Oppo Lauren style.
I am not.
I think that is actually kind of the point. When I was saying Facebook is going to become Google or whatever stupid way I said it, I think there is a path to that. Basically, when, let's say, I'm going to tie it all together, it's going to be beautiful. When the Master Chief video thing in Sydney gets released and posted by Microsoft on Facebook, you're going to be able to, someone is interested in Halo 5, and instead of going to Google to learn more about Halo 5, they're going to be able to go search on Facebook and get these kinds of posts that are going to be what they would have traditionally gotten on Google. I think there is a play for keeping people more into their ecosystem and making the content, the very large amount of content posted directly to Facebook, including video, which they've been making a big deal of in the past couple of years, surfaceable and accessible to all the people who are already on Facebook. So, yeah, I think it is a big deal.
Jack Dorsey gives back a third of his stock. I don't even... This is amazing. I love Jack Dorsey now. I love him. He only has a small percentage of Twitter stock, but as the new CEO of Twitter, he said...
About 4%. It's worth,
a lot of money. He's giving back $200 million, so that'll give you some idea. And it's going to go directly to employees. Well, that's pretty neat.
It's a nice conjunction with the layoffs that they had, isn't it?
Yeah, he cut 8% of the workforce, but the rest of you are going to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's a lot of people who felt that, I'm sure that felt that Jack moving into the CEO position in terms of prioritizing Twitter as, you know, the company that he cares about, you know, now that he's CEO of two companies. I think that, you know, it's an easy way for Jack to engender loyalty and trust in a way that feels like he believes in the company. And I think he does. I think it's genuine. I think he wants Twitter to succeed, obviously. But a lot of it is kind of also getting the employees on board and doing so by saying, like, here, I am giving this back to you guys so you can invest in Twitter.
Good. That's what you should do.
Yeah, and this comes, I think, a week or so after he pledged to give a huge chunk of Square to some charitable organizations.
You know, after your first $100 million, you really don't need more, right? I mean, or $500 million, whatever.
I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know either. But there's some point where you... Bill Gates said this. He said, at some point, you're infinitely rich. More money is not going to change your lifestyle at all. And maybe he just feels like, I got plenty. It's time to give back. He also said, I don't know if this is going to change anything. He wants to reset relationships with developers. It was Dick Costolo, his predecessor, who killed the third-party ecosystem, essentially, by limiting Twitter clients to 100,000 new users and so forth. You actually wrote a story saying the Twitter client has gotten better on the Mac side.
It will get better. Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. We're holding out hope that the Twitter for Mac client will finally be usable.
You were using TweetDeck, it looked like.
I am a TweetDeck loyalist.
That's also a Twitter client, isn't it?
Yes, but TweetDeck actually does, it was updated, so it has group DMs and emoji.
Group
and
DMs, like, what a concept.
Emoji support. You know, it's the little things, right? Twitter for Mac does not have those things yet. They promised them. It's kind of the moving forward and understanding that maybe they should be putting a lot more effort into their native apps rather than relying on third-party developers, or in this case with TweetDeck, a company that initially started out as a third-party developer but then was included under the Twitter umbrella. jury's still out. Again, like I said, I'm a TweetDeck loyalist. I'm all about it. I use the dark mode because I think I'm cool. And I think it works really well for me. But it all depends on sort of what they really want to do. And I think that this is them saying, like, not only are we investing in our apps, but we're also investing in developers to create more with our SDK and with our API to sort of do more and to make Twitter, you know, as exciting as it should be, given how big it is, given how big the platform is. The fact that they've been shut off to developers for so long now, it's kind of remarkable.
Do you think, though, that developers now, once bitten, will be twice shy? I mean, I would be nervous to make a new Twitter client at this point. I might move on to some other thing.
That's true, but there's so much information and data and
value
yeah. that Twitter has sort of stored away that I think that there will be some people who are really interested in creating something, even if it's just other companies. I mean, imagine what somebody could do by integrating, you know, Twitter and Slack. Then I would never have to leave my computer. Never. You know, put that thing on like some Google Cardboard, yeah, and I'll just live
just
my
headset.
Work.
Headset, Twitter,
the time.
And Slack. That's everything for you.
Basically,
that and K-pop and scrambled eggs, and you got life nailed.
Yes. Lauren, pug co-pilot. Pug co-pilot.
That we're working on the pug. You're an aspirational pug owner.
I'm an aspirational pug owner. This is true.
But you are the one and only Lauren Hawkinson. There is no one else. You'll find her on the next web or on the Twitter at LHOCKENSON.
That is correct.
Patrick Beja is also here. You'll find him at FrenchSpin.com or at NotPatrick, which is very confusing on the Twitter. Don't know what you're thinking there. He does own his own Heil PR40, though. That, to me, that's status.
And a lot of scarves.
And scarves. Also with us, Mark.
Oh, there's one right here.
Yeah, look. Mark Villian. Mark Villian from Bloomberg Business Week. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace. I love Squarespace. Squarespace is hosting plus the best software to give you an incredible experience as a website user, you know, somebody creating a website, and give your users an experience that is second to none. In fact, my Leoville site is now on the Squarespace, and I just love it. This is the new Squarespace cover page feature, which is fantastic. You can use it to give your visitors a quick glance of who you are. Actually, if you take the lower third down, Jason, you'll see I also have links to my social networks. And it links right into my blog. Look at this, animated GIFs. I'm going to see if I can put the 360 video on there. That would be awesome. For blogging, for your e-commerce, for your business, Squarespace. And the thing is, if everybody watching right now went to leoville.com, not only would I be happy, but you would not be able to bring a Squarespace site down. It is so robust. It is so strong. That's your view right there, Lauren, by the way. It's exactly what you're seeing right now. Squarespace.com. There's my old friends from Toronto. There's my old friend from the Screensavers. Here's the deal. Starts at $8 a month when you sign up for a year. You can build the most beautiful websites using state-of-the-art technology. You'd be crazy to try to do this on your own. They've hired the best designers to make great templates. They're all mobile responsive. That's not easy. They've got it done for you. They all have e-commerce. They have sites for a variety of different types of businesses. If you're a band, for instance, they've got sites for bands. They've got sites for restaurants. They don't look cookie cutter. They don't look like anything else. They look like you, like your ethos, your style. And that's what's so great about Squarespace. I want you to try it right now. In fact, it's easy to try. You don't even need a credit card. Just go to squarespace.com and click the Get Started button. You have 2 weeks to play with it. Pick the template. Change the template. It's so easy to change the template. You just click a button and the content stays and you look different. So easy to redesign your site to make it look exactly as you want it to with drag and drop. They have a developer platform, so if you are an HTML, JavaScript, CSS guru, you can do the sky's the limit. An incredible 24/7 customer support and a great support site too to make sure that if you have any questions, they will get answered. Try it free for 2 weeks. You can even import some of your content to see what the site would look like. It's a great way to get an idea of what Squarespace can do for you. And then if you decide to buy, 10% off when you use the offer code TWIT. And if you sign up for a business or commerce plan, $100 in AdWord credits as well, so you can start promoting your new site. Squarespace.com. Squarespace. Build it.
Beautiful.
Hey, if you missed this week on Twit, you missed a lot. Take a look.
Previously on Twit.
I don't do relatives' computers anymore. I say, if you insist on buying a Windows PC, I'm done. Thank you very much.
Before you buy.
Now, this is a much-awaited the Nexus 5X.
It takes all the things we loved about the 5, really good specs, really affordable price, and a pure Nexus experience, and puts it into a brand-new device for 2015.
Know-how.
One of the most requested things has been how to get rid of the Windows 10 nag screen. So we're going to show you how to get rid of the Windows 10 nag, at least until Microsoft counters it.
Tech News Today.
New reports reveal that police have successfully used DNA information from Ancestry.com as part of their police investigations, raising privacy concerns about access to such data.
I think this case was such a kind of a CSI kind of... that's what happens when you work at PopSci. I just got attacked by a drone.
Twit.
That was not planned, I swear.
Don't make me come back there.
Brian,
yes.
You know the nag, right?
I do know the nag, and I was able to get rid of it by upgrading to Windows 10.
And Mike Elgin is here with a look at the week ahead. Mike?
Coming up this week, the new Apple TV goes on sale tomorrow, which is Monday, October 26th, and shipments are expected by the end of the week. Motorola will unveil new Droid phones at an event in New York City on Tuesday, October 27th. Apple, Twitter, and Alibaba also release earnings on Tuesday. Google launches its YouTube Red ad-free subscription option on Wednesday, October 28th. Also on Wednesday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg will conduct one of his town hall Q&A sessions, this time in India. OnePlus will unveil its third smartphone in London on Thursday, October 29th. Thursday is also another big day for earnings. Expect to hear from Samsung, Sony, Nokia, LinkedIn, and Electronic Arts. And on Friday, October 30th, the Microsoft Band 2 fitness watch ships. For all this and the rest of the news this week, subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. Back to you, Leo.
Did you read Kara Swisher's latest in Recode? Kara, of course, has made her living with leaks from Yahoo. This may be the last one. Yahoo talent exodus accelerates as Marissa Meyer's turnaround flounders. Apparently, Yahoo's been trying to cover this up. In fact, Marissa's not been too happy about it either. She at a recent company-wide meeting, she put up photos of purple kittens to indicate a successful period of no leaks about the company's internal issues, including staff departures. But that never stopped Kara. Apparently, many executives leaving. There is a sense of doom, according to her, at Yahoo. Marissa Meyer's attempt to turn around the company is now being viewed inside as failing. The Yahoo situation is troubling, says one source. Another's worried about the ability of managers to staunch the flow of valued employees. And boy, when you read about it, two senior women execs left just last week. Development head Jackie Reese to Resses to Square. Marketing partnership head Lisa Licht. The CMO, Kathy Savitt, who was brought in by Meyer, just close to Meyer, now has left. Mike Kearns, SVP of Homepage and Verticals, left in April. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. People who just arrived departing very quickly. So I feel like Yahoo has so much value in it, but I also feel like it's been such a challenge, and Marissa Meyer was hired as CEO to turn it around. And you cannot say, looking at it, that in any way there's been a turnaround at Yahoo, right?
I think it depends on what you would consider to be the turnaround point. I guess I was I read something in the San Francisco Chronicle, I believe it was an AP story, regarding the possibility of Yahoo getting into the fantasy sports
They've actually
they have fantasy sports.
Oh, you mean the new thing?
Right? Yes,
the actual real money betting, which they've just started for the first time this season.
They just started real money betting, and it could be a really big boon for Yahoo Sports because it was a huge fantasy sports. You know, Bastion, and it's been for so long until DraftKings and FanDuel started eating its lunch and started getting real money payouts from it. I think that, you know, there are ways that Yahoo can sort of pivot or really push into new areas. But, I mean, that really comes at the behest of Meyer's judgment and what she sees as the image for the company, which, to be frank, I don't know if I see a clear one.
I feel like, and this it ties into Jonah Peretti's company-wide memo. Yahoo is very old school, right? The monolithic portal content company, content services company. And then you look at what BuzzFeed is doing, which is, I don't know if it's going to be successful or not, but very, very, almost the opposite. BuzzFeed creates content that they don't put on their own site. They put everywhere else. And I thought this was a great memo from Jonah Peretti, the founder and CEO of BuzzFeed, to his staff, which he then later put on the BuzzFeed blog, in which he basically said, we've been hiring like crazy. We've got talented reporters and storytellers and business people and engineers. We are building a global... It's interesting that he has to, in the memo to the company, explain what the company is doing. A global cross-platform network for news and entertainment, kind of the opposite of Yahoo. If Yahoo was a monolithic portal, BuzzFeed exists on Facebook and YouTube and everywhere else, wherever potential viewers are. He says, we see a post like 26 problems only anxious people will understand, which got 10 million views on our site, evolve into multiple videos with 10 million views across YouTube and Facebook, which turned into a comic on Instagram, then on our Snapchat Discover channel, and on and on and on. It's stories. It's global. It's multi-platform.
There are virtues to both media strategies, and there are drawbacks to, like, BuzzFeed's entire model is to some extent built around capturing lightning in a bottle. And have it,
viral.
You know,
if it's not viral,
you never know what's going to go viral.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can get an idea of what works and what doesn't, but you can never really know when you've got, like, the dress, for example,
right,
which is a phenomenon that still doesn't make any sense to me. The how people saw different
the
colors of the dress. Yeah, exactly.
Dress.
Black and gold.
Yeah.
Whereas Yahoo has the advantage of, like, Sunday's NFL game that aired in London is on Yahoo. It's a perfect example of taking something that's incredibly boring, the worst game of the week, Jaguars versus Bills, at 6:30 in the morning in San Francisco. And driving tens of millions of people to it, likely. They haven't announced numbers yet, but driving millions of people to it. I think your phone's ringing.
That's somebody at my front door. Just ignore that. I'll turn it off.
Being able to drive millions of people to an extremely uninteresting event because they put the video everywhere and make it autoplay and you know, they can create their own.
Well, they can
phenomenon.
Also monetize it, right? Because it's a lot easier to monetize that than it is a post on Facebook or a post on YouTube. I mean...
Yeah, arguably they didn't do a great job of monetizing this particular event. They had to undersell some of the ads, I think.
I think, though, the point that BuzzFeed is making is that people no longer go to a site.
No, many people,
right?
Many people do.
So,
definitely, it's going in a different direction, but Yahoo's homepage still drives
huge.
many millions of people.
Yeah. Well, and certainly, so like Bloomberg, people are going to go to because they're on a mission. But it must be challenging for somebody like the New York Times, where people don't go to the front page and browse the Times. They go to links that they see on Twitter and Facebook and follow those links, and that's what BuzzFeed's trying to capitalize on. I'm sorry, Patrick. Go ahead.
And I think that's what BuzzFeed has been doing really well. First, because they manage against all odds to capture some amount of, you know, lightning in a bottle, because they do get very
viral. They're good at making viral
posts.
Videos. I've never seen anybody so good at it.
It's incredibly exploitative. They make those kinds of listicles that honestly make any I was going to say any serious journalist, but really any journalist kind of roll their eyes.
Well, it almost feels algorithmic. It feels like they're applying a computer algorithm to make something be viral.
I'm sure they are. They have formulas, but beyond that, I think they look at the way the articles are taking off, and then they're pushing the ones that really start taking off a lot more. And you see them everywhere. And what you're right, Leo. The lesson is for a lot of publications, they have to sort of divorce themselves from this idea of content ownership. It's a very, very dangerous and counterintuitive thing to do, but you have to be willing to let go and to put your content everywhere people will want to see it. Because if you don't, people are just not going to see it. And ironically, BuzzFeed has been starting to do actual investigative journalism. That is, you know, they've had some pretty substantial articles.
As is Vice, another company kind of built the same way. Mm-hmm. Lauren, you said it though. You don't go. All you need is Slack and Twitter. You don't go. You don't open your browser and go to your homepage, your My Yahoo page.
No, I don't. But I think that it brings up an interesting point, right? When you look at something that's cross-platform like BuzzFeed, what you're seeing is a division between two different kinds of BuzzFeed reader. You know, the people who click on those Me Too listicles, or like I like to say, I actively say to my computer, "Oh, that is so me." All those posts that make you go, "That is so me."
So me
is what BuzzFeed is really known for. They want you to click on the article that is so you, that's so about you. But at the same time, there are other different ways of news gathering. I mean, I spend my time on Twitter and I follow different news sources and I get it directly there. And every once in a while, you know, I'll see something from another social site, or it'll come up in my RSS or however, you know, I choose to get news at that specific moment in time. But what BuzzFeed is trying to capture is this instance where it's like, sure, I'm not going to click on Me Too posts on Facebook. I'm not going to click on, you know, 10 reasons why, you know, girls who went to college in Boston love coffee. Like, I don't care about
those
things.
That's so you.
Yeah, it's so me, though. It's so me, but I don't want to click on it. I think that what we see is we see those people, and they're on Facebook. What we see, you know, people on Twitter who perhaps are searching for, you know, specific news sources and may follow BuzzFeed. We're seeing people on YouTube or on Instagram or on Vine who are following BuzzFeed, or they're going on Snapchat Discover, or they're going through BuzzFeed's, you know, native app. What we're seeing is this idea that BuzzFeed is saying, which is just, why do we need to have a site for all of this? How can we, you know, integrate it more? And I think, you know, that we're seeing it, you know, in a real way being played out, you know, by another media company, and that would be Business Insider. They have their Insider.
INSS.
Insider. That's different from Business Insider. It's different from TechInsider.io. Yes,
they
have Insider, which is, it doesn't have a website at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't have... It's really hard to search for because you just want to look.
How do you search for it?
Yeah, but it's just there. You know, it's one of those things.
Because nobody is supposed to go to it.
Yeah, it's just called Insider. The Insider. I think that might be right.
No, that's wrong. That's another Insider.
So what you're seeing is, but they have this thing, it's called Insider, and they have, you know, Instagram, and they have other methods that they're delivering news.
You can't
and
find it.
I know. But part of it is that they're then, well, that has to do with the fact that Google doesn't allow, you know, Facebook or Twitter searches, but the idea is that you're going to come across this stuff natively, and you're not going to want to spend a lot of time bouncing around a website. You're going to want to consume that video or that news here we go. TechInsider.io/latest.
TechInsider.
Thanks, Virgil, in the chat.
Insider.io. Okay.
/latest. But what it is it's designed to be that sort of native experience. Whether or not that's something that's effective, I mean, it's untested. It's yet to be proven.
And the reason they don't care if you go to that page, you're not supposed to go to that page. This is supposed to be linked from everywhere else to that, right?
I believe that they also have other stuff. I'm not exactly sure how it works. I'm not really that hip on the TI.io. what I do know is that they're really trying to push to make this native play. And trying to get people who are actively within those social networks.
Listen to the headlines. They're just viral. Absolutely viral. Mm-hmm. It looks like Aaron Sorkin's new Steve Jobs movie is a flop. Why is it impossible to try Google's new great phones? The man who helped create the iPod reveals the moment he and his wife decided to leave Apple.
I mean, viral. I've caught the viral infection.
People are carving Trumpo lanterns. Apple just put out a new...
Making me feel dirty.
How to stop Windows 7 from constantly asking you to upgrade to Windows 10. These are 10 of the best wildlife pictures taken in the last 20 years. These 5 Game of Thrones characters recast and you probably didn't even notice.
Yeah.
And on and on and on.
So, and I think that...
I bet it's really successful, too.
Well, it's the separation between, you know, content and news and...
Pizza is the key to this strange economic principle. How could you not click that? How could you not click that?
I don't know, but if it's not about a pie chart, I'm out of here.
Steve Kovac, though, who's a regular on this show, is the guy who wrote the iPhone 6S screen is so sensitive it can weigh things.
Oh, no, that's the best one. Scientists have an idea of why everyone is obsessed with bacon.
Bacon is automatically viral. Yeah. Just put the word bacon in.
But I think that it comes down to the fact is whether or not these sites, what their end goal is. If it's to create thoughtful reporting, which BuzzFeed does time and time again, especially, you know, even in its tech section. I mean, shout out to Matt Honan. He's great at what he does.
Yeah.
And he does a lot
Matt
of great reporting.
Matt stories like crazy.
All the time. And they have Natasha Tiku over there now. And they just have people.
But you almost feel like that's them trying to cover up what they're really up to. Like, yeah, let's hire some prestigious reporters, break some news, then nobody will pay attention to what we're really trying to do, which is basically Upworthy.
Yeah, basically. So on the Bacon article, there are two See Also articles that actually have a picture of the American flag made out of bacon. I think that sort of proves the point.
Okay, don't tell me the URL because I got to do an ad right now and I don't want to be distracted. We'll talk about the GIF election, or is it GIF election? We can fight over that. I think it was a black dress. But first, a word from Lynda.com, the online learning platform made for you. You're curious. You want to learn. You're smart. You want to make things happen. Get a better job. Get better at your job. Get better at your hobby, photography, or coding. Lynda.com has everything for the curious mind. If you're interested in photography, you want to... take better photos, you got to check out Lynda, Lynda.com. Two new courses that are fabulous. One of them taught by a good friend of mine who's one of my favorite photographers, Ben Long, The Introduction to Photography, Getting Started with Photography. They do a 5-day photo challenge to help improve your composition skills. And for the high-end, heavy-duty folks, new courses on things like color correction, making selective adjustments in Adobe Camera Raw, Lightroom Essential Training, the fundamentals of Photoshop. There's Ben. Look, they get the best teachers, the most. These guys are passionate about their subject. They teach well. They communicate their passion. And these are videos that are shot professionally. These are not YouTube videos. This is great content. You get a transcript so you can search right to the part of the show you want, or you can go beginning to end. You can download your tutorials and watch them on the go. I just love Lynda.com. And what we've done is we've set it up so that you can experience it for 10 days just like you were a paying subscriber, the run of the place. That's one of the things I like. You pay a flat monthly fee, and you don't have to choose ahead of time what courses you want to take. You can take any of them. More than 3,000 courses. You could take any of them. So dabble all you want. No need to pick a major. Just go to lynda.com/twit2 and have 10 days to run around and see the stuff you can see, learn the stuff you can learn. Certainly enough time to take a few courses, but what I want you to do is get an idea of what Lynda.com can offer you so you can sign up. Lynda.com/twit and the number 2 for your free 10-day trial. They've also got courses on business skills like resume building, negotiation, and how to run businesses, too, leadership skills. Lynda, Lynda.com/twit2. I did not watch the 11-hour marathon of Hillary Clinton testifying before Congress in the Benghazi investigation, but I did think what was interesting is Matt Bohr's article about it on Medium, of course. He's pointing out now that apparently Clinton has become a master of the GIF, the animated GIF. And it does seem to be... There are a few moments in the testimony where she was clearly aware that she was creating a moment that would be spread virally. You know, it's not just Jonah Peretti who's figured out that the best way to get attention is to go viral. I think Donald Trump's figured that
out.
She
is the cross-platform candidate.
She is the... Look at this. Brushing it off. You don't think that was unconscious. That was very clearly conscious. This... That's made for a GIF. So I think what he's pointing out in his article is, by the way, here are some of the headlines. 8 times Hillary Clinton didn't care in GIFs. Hillary's testimony before the Benghazi committee in GIFs. This is the greatest Hillary Clinton Benghazi reaction GIF ever. Image. He says GIFs matter. A fast traveling GIF bite will prove devastating for candidates unable to preemptively supply the public with GIFable reactions and gestures to fit the campaign's narrative. Is this the election we're heading into, folks? Nixon sweating, Bush checking his watch, Dukakis in a tank. This election will produce GIFs that will negatively shape the perception of candidates until the day they leave the earth. I love this. He says candidates need to sit down and address their GIF plan.
I wouldn't know.
I don't know.
I totally believe this.
I wouldn't exactly say that Hillary is the master of the graphics interchange format. I believe that that would have to go to Drake.
Okay.
The rapper Drake.
I'm not saying she invented it,
but
she's the first politician to think about this and consciously manipulate it.
Little known, he invented the image format.
Yeah, that too. He almost called it the DIF. It was the Drake interchange
the diff,
format.
Man.
But he was too busy on Degrassi. He couldn't work it out in time. Actually, though, when you look through, you know, something like your Twitter stream and you see, you know, Hillary Clinton, Hotline Bling, huge.
Hotline Bling.
All the I say GIF as well, but GIF, GIF, the GIF or GIF of Drake dancing is... pretty.
You put GIFs in your Twitter feed, like in reaction, like
if yes,
yes.
I have a folder. It's on my desktop.
Yeah.
It is separated by feelings, and
what?
It allows me.
No.
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
No.
So you have on your desktop folders for different feelings,
yes.
And when you tweet and you want to express a feeling, you will look in that folder and find the right GIF.
Yes. Except for...
I got to start following you.
Except for I actually have a job on Twitter, and that is to provide a very specific image to Alex Wilhelm, who is also a
love
friend
Alex.
Of the show.
Yep.
And it
Did
happens
he
to be
put
a very
you
specific
up to this?
Image. No. But I said when the other day, which is, I believe it, I just captioned it Thursday. It's all the way down. I think because I
tweet
a lot,
apparently. Yeah,
I tweet a lot. And I was sick this week too, which is remarkable. That's one I didn't actually make that one, but there's one further that one I made.
So what folder is this in?
That's the dancing folder or the working folder, depending.
Do you have a folder on your desktop?
I don't have any folders. Although GIFs are pretty popular in our Slack. But we take the
it's Slack that created this problem.
Slack perpetuates the problem. I don't know if it created.
Yeah, the Jiffy bot,
Jiffy
which
bot.
Is our. We take the lazy shortcut, which is you do slash Jiffy and then you just type in any keyword and it pulls up a random one. Usually, it makes no sense the options that it chooses.
I wonder if
it's part of the fun.
See, so I first became aware of Slack when I was working with our developers in Austin for the new website, and this is what they use. And apparently, they're very aware of all of this. So, what is it? It's
Jiffy.
/Jiffy.
PHY, yep. Right?
Yeah.
This really
and
doesn't help the
dancing.
Pronounce it Giphy.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not allowed to use this word. Command. I've been blocked.
Ouch.
I've been Jiffy blocked.
You must have abused it.
Holy cow. Thanks, Four Kitchens, blocking me from the Jiffy. I might have done that to myself because I think there's a command you could say. I don't want to see those GIFs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have done that. Awesome. So Drake invented the GIF?
I mean,
no, I think that what you see here is the phenomenon that Hillary is also doing, which is that you have these specific actions or reactions that you can use really easily and share them really quickly, and it can mean a lot. You know, you can put that up and you can just say, like, that face when... You've had it.
She's not a stranger to the meme. There's that picture of her with the sunglasses looking at her BlackBerry, right? Wasn't there a whole meme of her in the Situation Room?
Yes.
Yeah. It was Hillary Clinton checking her BlackBerry, I think was the official name of the meme. But I mean, I browse Reddit a lot. I use and tweet GIFs as much as the next guy. But does that do anything for her, though? Is that something you can control? And it's just as likely that it's going to damage her image as it is that it's, I mean,
not
look at this,
if you
this specific GIF.
Yeah. So if you, yeah, but I'm telling you, that's why you got to take control.
This How? Is
because you got to spin it because this, so you need to, I don't know how, but I don't know how BuzzFeed does viral videos either. I think there's a way to win over the GIFing population.
I think it has a very strong Venn diagram overlap with the "that is so me" population. I think that I think that comes together to bring it back.
How about Boomerang? Does that count? The new Instagram app, the one second back and forth. That seems like a lazy GIF strategy.
It is the easiest way of creating GIFs that anyone has found on mobile. People have been trying to crack that nut for a year now, and I think Boomerang is the one that comes the closest.
I like the Google Photos auto-stitch. If you shot a bunch of photos, then they'll recommend GIFs
used those.
And create those. Yeah, those are good.
Yeah. So here's, apparently there's a site, textfromhillary.com, mm-hmm. Tumblr. So here's Joe Biden, he's talking to the president saying she's just going to love the new Justin Bieber video. And she texts back to her voice.
I think this is good.
Great. I think this is good for her in a certain demographic.
It's my second
favorite. But she didn't.
What's your favorite? Wait a minute, I got to find out what her favorite is. Then you could talk, Patrick.
Joe Biden eats ice cream.tumblr.com, which is just pictures of Joe Biden eating ice cream.
A lot of ice cream?
Sometimes he's eating two ice creams.
Go ahead, Patrick, while I search for Joe Biden eats ice cream.
I want to see that too, but I mean, it's like, you know, Kim Jong Il or is it Kim Jong Un looking at things? It's the nature of virality. There's no way you can control it, first of all, and certainly Hillary Clinton didn't do anything special to create that badass text sending persona for herself, and I don't think that anyone can create positive GIFs in the campaign.
This is such a badass picture. Of Joe Biden flashing a 20 while he's eating ice cream.
Two Hamiltons and a vanilla cone.
Apparently he eats a lot of ice cream.
He does.
Yeah, you're pointing some out here so I won't miss any, right?
There's one where he is eating two ice creams.
Seems to go more cone than cup.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure
I'm
I agree
a more
with.
Cone than cup kind of guy.
This is a more than one page Tumblr.
Oh,
which
my
is
God, yes. This goes on and on and on.
He got older.
Yeah.
There it is. There's the one where he's eating two.
Joe the double-fisted ice cream eater.
That's my favorite. I love text from Hillary. Don't get me wrong. I think that's what she's really good at is making these like reproducible and shareable situations. But for my money, it's all about Joey B with his vanilla cone.
Two Hamiltons and a cone.
Right. He's not running, but this is the platform he could run on.
I'm telling you.
Joe eats ice cream.
I'm telling you. If you are a modern day politician, one of the reasons Trump's doing so well, they analyzed the speech, the text of all of the candidates. Hillary's a 10th grade level. Mm-hmm. Even Ben Carson is like an 8th grade level. Donald Trump, 4th grade level. And you know what? That's not a bad thing because when he says politicians are stupid, it resonates with people. They get it. I know what that means. And I'm telling you, the GIF is the new soundbite.
But the argument of Matt Boers is exactly that. It's, you know, the Republicans are going for the soundbite, trying to get the soundbite. And, you know, Hillary is trying to get the GIF. I think that's a completely flawed argument. You can actually go for the soundbite. You can control it, but you cannot control getting the GIF. That's like saying, oh, you know, those viral videos. We have to get ourselves some of that.
All right, All right, Lauren, throw me some shade.
Oh, I can't throw. No,
you don't know how to throw shade?
Oh,
I'm gonna,
oh, I know how to throw shade, but I can't do it on command.
Oh, okay. You did actually know? Just throw me some shade.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know what. So well, now see, that's the gif that it made. That's not a flattering.
It's an eye independent from another. It's not great.
All right, let's do this again.
I don't spend a lot of time.
All right, like, Mark Millian, yeah, throw me some shade. Oh, nice. He did a little Jay-Z thing.
Here.
Oh, yeah.
Here. Now that I'm prepared.
Oh, wait a minute. I got to save that. Wait a minute. Where do I put that? Instagram, right? Okay. Lauren, can you
do GIFs on Instagram?
Yeah.
Yeah, because this is an Instagram app.
Because they do video. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Dude. All right. Share that sucker. All right. Now we're going to go back.
Finally.
And Lauren's going to do, now you just tell me when you're going to do it. Wait a minute, I'm in the wrong app. Hold on a second. Damn you, Instagram. You got too many apps. I'm done. That's saved.
Okay, ready?
Yeah. Ooh, I think that was good.
Yeah.
No, do that again. Its okay. Timing is hard on this. Wait a minute. Now, what is it going to do? Is it going to blink, blink, blink? Is that what it does when you're about to go? Oh, yeah. I missed it. Okay, wait a minute. Ready, set. Not yet. Wait till I say go. Well, that's good, too. Go.
Did you get it? No. See?
It's hard to do.
This is going to be a tough segment to listen to in the audio version.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I apologize to everybody.
I don't know if it's any easier to watch, but...
No, it's worse to watch, frankly. It'd be better to imagine something exciting happening. We're out of time. I'm not going to spend any time talking about Pandora and the fact that all of this... Companies are about to just go collapse.
Bad quarter.
Pandora had to pay $90 million to the RIAA for playing the Turtles Happy Together and everything else that happened before 1972. They played it without paying. Now they have to pay for the play, and they're losing money like crazy. Investors are turning away. But see, it's not just Pandora. The whole problem is all of these companies, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, are beholden to the record companies. The record companies have them. Mm-hmm. There's nothing they can do about it. So
if we're doing a lightning round,
the
Steve Jobs movie bombed.
So early results are in from the first
opening weekend,
the 23rd. This is the opening weekend. How much money?
$7.3 million.
How many
in the U.S.
theaters?
And Canada?
Does it say? That's pretty weak.
It's about a third of what the estimates were.
Yeah,
and it clocked in at number 7.
Heavily marketed, number 7.
It was expected to do very well.
I don't think it's because people are thinking it's a bad movie. I think it's because people don't care about Steve Jobs. Who cares? I can go see that or Bridge of Spies or The Martian.
Just for the record, it's just being
what
by
that
Goosebumps.
Means.
Goosebumps is beating it. R.L. Stein's Goosebumps.
Yeah.
Irma Gerd.
Yep. Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay.
The Tech Insider article that we made fun of was apparently right. The movie did suck.
Yeah.
I mean, bomb. There's the, if you want an uplifting end note.
Yes.
There's the self-driving cars that have to kill people.
This is a fascinating story.
It's really interesting.
This comes from MIT's Technology Review. And it says, if you're going to do autonomous vehicles... You've got to solve a really challenging ethical dilemma. What do you do when you have to make the decision between, say, for instance, killing your occupants, your owners, or plowing into a crowd? How should the car be programmed to act in the event of an unavoidable accident? Should it minimize the loss of life, even if it means sacrificing the occupants, or... As I would like it to do, should it protect the occupants at all costs? And how does it do this? And I think this is actually going to be one of the more intractable problems that have to be solved before we have self-driving cars. Or maybe the companies will just ignore it and let the computer just algorithmically.
Yeah, but you can't. You can't ignore it. You have to write the algorithm that's going to decide.
I got another idea. What if you just, okay, you're writing the algorithms. What are you doing with that? You're saying avoid an accident, period. Just avoid an accident. You don't even address the unavoidable accident. You say avoid an accident at all costs.
And see where the chip falls.
And see what happens. The car's going to, it can't avoid an accident. It's going to get in an accident. And then what will happen.
Yeah, but that's how we got Christine.
That's what happened.
That's how we get Christine.
or Killdozer. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is a very upbeat note to end this show with, Patrick. You're absolutely right.
You're welcome.
Patrick Beja is, I love it. I love Patrick. And he's doing it all on his own now. What's your Patreon page so we can get you some moolah?
Oh, well, thank you. There's a couple. The Le Rendezvous Tech, it's patreon.com/RDVTech. And there is the patreon.com/The Phileas Club, which is a show I do in English, which I get people from different countries in the world together every month or so. We did one episode last week. And the one before was a special where we talked to my friend Turkey from Saudi Arabia. And he told us about everyday life in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, how
that's
interesting.
Something you don't hear about very often.
Yeah. So depending on the language of choice, you could LDV Tech or the Phileas
Club. Or the Phileas Club, yeah.
You know,
and of course, I'm on, I'm on Daily Tech News Show with Tom Merritt most Tuesdays.
Nice. I mean, I really think this is an amazing thing. I mean, we make Twit work by selling ads, and we've been around for so long that we're able to do that. But maybe it would be a different Twit if Patreon had been around 10 years ago. I think this is just really fantastic that it exists. And I congratulate you.
I think
on
it addresses. Thank you. It addresses different levels of audiences. I think for an English show that has the popularity your network enjoys, it makes sense to go ad supported. For, you know, the intermediate levels, I think Patreon works really well.
Well, absolutely. And I think the promise of the internet is this kind of democratization of media. And that means there will be shows at all levels. And they need to be able to exist at all levels. So I'm really thrilled that this works. That's great. Thank you, Patrick. Great to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Millian for stopping by from Bloomberg Business Week. Anything you want to plug? What you up to these days?
Bloomberg.com/tech. It's all the good stuff you need to read every
day. You
have
the terminal running on your Mac there, and I was just looking at it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I was looking up Yahoo's cash position, $6.8 billion.
Oh, is it dwindling?
Yeah, well, in fiscal 2014, it was $10.2 billion.
It's dwindling.
It is indeed dwindling.
It's like dwindling at a rapid rate.
When you spend $17 million on one NFL game, that can...
Yikes. They bought the rights to that? Not the other way around, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Of course they did. And, you know, there's nothing like watching the NFL at 6 in the morning.
Mm.
Man, that's fun. Lauren Hawkinson is at The Next Web. You're kind of new there.
Yes. I mean, I joined in July. So.
And that's been great? You've had fun?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a tech journalist before, and then I stepped out of the game and sat behind a desk for a little bit.
Awful.
And then, awful. I was watching TV at work. And
I did the same thing. I thought, you know, I was in radio. I thought, this is not a job for a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work for a startup. And then 3 months later, I was like, it was going crazy. It was nuts.
Yeah. I missed the pace of it.
Yeah.
So now I'm back at The Next Web. I am the San Francisco reporter.
Nice.
Writing all things San Francisco as much as possible.
It's a great beat, isn't it?
I love it.
So much fun.
It's really great. And then in my off time, I have a podcast that I run.
What's your podcast?
Yes. It is called Nothing Matters. It is available on SoundCloud and on iTunes. You can also subscribe to it via your app, whichever app of choice that you have. I confirmed I'm on Overcast, but we are on go to SoundCloud.com.
There are other Nothing Matters podcasts?
No, we're the only one.
Okay. Oh, you're smart. You do it on SoundCloud.
Yes, we do it on SoundCloud.
That's great.
And I talk about more than just tech there. I talk about news. Basically, the entire subject of the podcast is all the garbage that you probably missed on Twitter. We talk about basically everything. We're No Matters Cast on Twitter.
No Matters Cast.
Yes, and we're SoundCloud.com/NothingMattersCast.
This is confusing.
I know.
Apparently, there are many people who agree with you.
It's a new podcast. I've only been doing it for about a month. So happy to get feedback. And
there you go.
Yes, there it is.
Everything, you're just burning the house down.
Yes, it's all about fires, and we do garbage fires on Twitter.
I'm going to listen. This looks good.
We talk a lot about
Pizza things. Rat.
We talked about Pizza Rat for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Pizza Rat is actually, we're trying to talk with his agent to see if he will come on and guest on the cast.
I think Pizza Rat could run for president. Pizza Rat's got strong GIF.
I think that if we went Donald Trump, Pizza Rat, that ticket would be really hot.
Who would vote for that?
Pizza Rat truthers.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you all for being here. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. Tune in live, live.twit.tv or twit.tv/live. They both work. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. If you can't watch live, I love it if you do, but if you can't watch live, you can always get it on demand after the fact at twit.tv and wherever you find your podcasts. If you want to be in the studio audience, we love having you. Thank you for coming. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. Put a canned ham under the chair. No, we don't. No, we do not. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can. Amazing. Bye-bye.